and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff this week on the show. In addition to some news-related topics and things like that, we're going to be talking about Gravity Rush 2.
Yes.
New video game. Pretty much spoiler-free. Not that I think that's a game you can spoil in a horrible way.
As someone who has actually finished the game, there is some shit that happens in that story. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so far I was thinking it. Yeah, I love the story, but I wasn't necessarily thinking that. So that's exciting. Yeah, just to let you guys know, I have not finished the game yet for reasons I will tell you in a little bit.
Yeah.
But Sean has. So quick spoiler-free reaction.
I love this game to death. Yeah, I finished it, I guess, 2 nights ago, and then I've been sort of cleaning up some trophy stuff since then. I almost have the platinum. There's one trophy left I need to get, and that trophy, you kind of can't get it like just by sort of like spending a bunch of time with the game. You have to sort of like come back a couple of days like later to sort of have events repopulate because there's some small online stuff. But other than that, like I have done basically every single thing you can do in the game. I got all the collectibles. I did all the side missions. Got gold on all the challenges and all that. And yeah, I think it's just, if you are someone who liked the first Gravity Rush game, I think this is an absolute must play. It is everything that was good about Gravity Rush 1, like taken up to 11, like all the ways that they've sort of added on and modified your gravity powers is fantastic. The soundtrack is incredible. The graphics are amazing. And I think the biggest improvement is honestly in the story. And it's like the story in both big ways and small ways. And it is a much longer game than Gravity Rush 1. And there's sort of a lot more story. And it's really impressive to see the ways they sort of tackle both like very grounded social issues, and particularly the Jirga Power Lao section that's like very much about like class issues and like class conflict and socioeconomic stratification and stuff like that. And it's very savvy in how I think it tackles a lot of those issues. And then also the game talks about a lot more of the sort of big philosophical things that the Gravity Rush 1 was like, you know, like the nature of time and bullshit like that. And I think it does those things more successfully than Gravity Rush 1 did. And by the time I ended the game, I did have like, I think, a surprisingly strong emotional reaction that maybe is partially, I think, like, myself and a lot of people are probably feeling kind of vulnerable based on, like, what is going on in the world right now. That made me slightly more receptive to the stuff going on in the story. But I think it is just a really interesting story told really effectively with characters that, like, I've just fallen in love with completely at this point. And, yeah, Gravity Rush 2 is, like, I had very high expectations for Gravity Rush 2 coming out of playing Remastered last year. And it completely blew my expectations out of the water.
It's a great game. Yeah, let's mention really quickly. We're recording this Sunday night, the 29th. The world's burning.
Yeah, bad shit's going down.
You know, frankly, by the time this podcast publishes in the morning, things could have gotten exponentially worse or slightly better if some certain people grow a spine.
Yeah.
But, I'm not... I'll say I was hesitant about recording a podcast at all this weekend. I was of the mind of like, I don't know if I or anyone else is in the mood to talk about stupid shit right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, to paraphrase Childish Gambino, sometimes that stupid shit is real shit. And you just got to keep on keeping on, I guess, with it.
Yeah.
But, man, a lot of people who I hope get the help they need.
Yeah, I will say it's a weird phenomenon where the world is so awful and like the some people at the top are so just blatantly evil that it makes like playing a game like Gravity Rush 2, where some of the villain characters in that game, particularly later on, are like really over the top kind of anime cliche sort of villains that last year or like 2 years ago I would have seen that and rolled my eyes and be like, this is just ridiculous. And then I've like looking at the news about like, you know, Trump issuing like unlawful, unconstitutional executive orders to sort of keep people from immigrating to our country. And I look at that and I'm like, oh, okay, maybe Gravity Rush 2 is actually being a bit more subtle than I was giving, or all this stuff was being more subtle than you give it credit for,
or
the world is falling apart.
Or installing a literal neo-Nazi to the National Security Council.
No, yeah, that's bad.
No, there's no way you can go further over the top than that.
Yeah.
There really isn't.
You know, truth is stranger than fiction. I feel like I'm understanding that phrase more and more the older I get.
No, I mean, I have a lot to say about Gravity Rush 2, and we'll talk about it. And again, this we'll probably talk about story more next week.
Yeah.
As we often do with these kind of discussions. But it is surprisingly resonant. It is also a great piece of escape in some ways.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing more fun or relaxing in video games than collecting gems in Gravity Rush.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And but, there are a lot of them in this one.
Oh Jesus, there are a lot. I love that the trophy for this one is, I think, 60,000 gems.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Not that I think that's outlandish or anything for the number of gems in the game. But,
no, but that's like 50% more, because I would loaded up Gravity Rush Remastered earlier today just to sort of like compare it. I was looking at those trophies, I'm like, oh yeah, that's there's a lot more gems in Gravity Rush 2 based on these trophies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway, I was going to just try to power through. It's a dark time for the world, but I don't know. Maybe we can try to have a little fun talking about these things tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Gravity Rush 2, you should play it. It's great.
Yes.
I think it's interesting because it's a game that is in a lot of ways, a straight sequel to Gravity Rush 1 in that it takes the same things and does more with it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's not at all. It's very different in some ways in terms of its overall structure and some tonal things. In some ways, it presents story. So it really does feel like the ideal sequel to a great original game where it takes what made that game great and expands upon it without losing the heart of that game.
Yeah.
And that is the one thing I was afraid of in a bigger, like, console-based sequel to Gravity Rush is, will that erode any of the things that made the original special? And the answer, thankfully, is no.
No, yeah. Like, I mean, they have been making this game for, like, 5 years, and you can just feel that this is the game they wanted to make the entire time. And in some ways, like, when you see the game to its conclusion, like, it feels like Gravity Rush... It, like in Gravity Rush 2, like, should kind of all be one giant mega game in some ways that it's just like got split in terms of like some of the ways they planned out where the story goes and stuff.
Well, because it is kind of Gravity Rush 1, if you haven't played it, and we haven't talked about it a ton on here,
because
you and I played it at different times, but one of the fascinating things that I actually like about Gravity Rush 1 is that it's not one overarching story. It's like a little series of mini, like, vignette stories over the course of that game that's really just a light kind of origin story for Cat and Raven and the powers in this world. And then it's like with Gravity Rush 2, they're like, okay, now we're going to tell a real story with these characters. Yeah. And it works out great. Also, I want to say I watched the anime.
Yes, that's fantastic.
It's so good.
Yeah, I rewatched it earlier today. Like, basically, I was rewatching it while I was eating lunch. Because it's really good before you play the game. And then when you understand all the stuff that it's talking about and you go back to it, like, it's even better. Like, it's the same way with the Persona 5 Daybreakers animation. That thing is really cool. And then when you play the game and you go back to it, you see all the stuff that it's hinting at. You're like, oh, shit. Like, you'd see it in a totally different light.
Yeah, but, like, the animation in that is so great. Uh-huh. And just the... Like, I want a Gravity Rush anime. Like, that is one game that would translate to anime sort of perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like, and I love their commitment in this series to the silly made-up language.
Yeah, the weird, like, Frenchy Japanese, just like, shikabarafu!
Yeah, it's like, okay. It's like French and Japanese, two very different languages, got drunk in a bar and fucked.
Yeah.
And that's what you have, and it's kind of beautiful in a weird way.
Da but fuda! Also,
yeah.
Yeah.
And they,
I've been hearing a lot of it the past weeks.
Like, you get to know phrases in a weird way, and it's like, because there's a lot of voice acting in Gravity Rush 2.
There is.
More than you would normally get for a game with a made-up language, you know?
Yeah.
Because that made-up language thing is something you get in handheld games sometimes, because it's like, we're only going to have 10 lines, let's do it.
Yeah.
But with this one, they're like, oh, now it's a big console game, should we make a real language? No. We're sticking
like,
with it.
Well, we're making this fully voiced, like, 30-minute, basically, anime episode. Should we just say, like, well, fuck it, it'll just be in Japanese? Like, no, it's subtitled for everyone.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't matter if you're, like, it is subs all the way on Gravity Rush the animation. There's no version of that is dubbed.
It would just be so amazing if they did, like, a full, like, 12-episode anime run and just did that the whole way through.
Yeah, and then Funimation picks up, and then they do an English dub that is just English people saying the made-up bullshit language, and it's still subtitled.
I would enjoy that. All right, so let's go ahead and move on and talk about some other stuff. My only piece of stuff to talk about is the reason why I was kind of late finishing Gravity, or I'm not done with it yet, but I will be late finishing Gravity Rush 2, is that I had also been playing Persona 4 Golden, as you will remember, on my New Game Plus run. And I was thinking if I didn't finish it in time for Gravity Rush 2, I would put the game aside. Persona 4 is long. I think there are spots where you can kind of set it down and come back to it.
Sure.
But the spot where I was about to set it down, I kind of forgot where certain things arrived in that game because it's been 4 years since I played it. And one night I was playing it, and I jumped kind of unexpectedly into the section of the game where a certain sad, adorable girl gets kidnapped.
Okay, yeah. And where you enter the last, like, arc of the game.
Yep.
And which, by last arc, like, the last 20 hours or whatever the game
is. It's a huge chunk of the game, but, like, from when I started that was, like, last Monday night, I started playing that. Played until, like, 2 in the morning, just watching the cutscenes and stuff. And then, basically, every free moment I had been playing, you know, like sprinting through to the end of Persona 4 Golden, and man, some of the like I think the actual like the true ending stuff and some of the stuff near the end I think is weak, and we've talked about that before. And again, weak relative to the greatness of Persona 4, not weak relative to all storytelling. But I, you know, the part with Nanako, mild spoiler, and everything that happens there, like there's just some unbelievably good storytelling that happens down the home stretch of that game.
Yeah.
You know, we pay a lot of attention to how great the home stretch of Persona 3 is, and it is the best, but Persona 4 packs some fucking punches near the end.
No, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I do have more stuff I want to talk about with it. Maybe we'll loop about round back around at the end and do a little spoiler talk on that, because there are... We talked about it years ago, but there are certain things we didn't get to talk about yet with Persona
4. So have you finished Persona 4 the Golden for the second time, your New Game Plus?
Yes.
You're okay.
Yeah, I finished it.
I assume you got like all the social links and everything.
Yep. There are some bullshit trophies in that game.
Oh, hey, yeah, as someone who's got as close as one person could on their first playthrough of that game, I know what you mean.
Yeah, like I'm never going to get all the trophies. There's another, like the Thorough Bookkeeper one is, not Thorough, but Thorough Bookkeeper is the Compendium one. I did get that.
Yeah.
Maxed out my Compendium, maxed out social links, all that basic stuff. The one where you have to like read all the books, though, I forget what that one's called.
Sure.
That one is horseshit. I just have to say, because there are missable books that I did not like that you have to collect in like sort of random Sunday people will call you up events.
Mm-hmm,
and I learned about some of those later, and it's just I'm fucked. I don't, you know, I don't have a save from May 29th in the game to go. And even if I did, I'd have to play through the rest of it again.
Yeah.
Like there are just very missable trophies. That, anyway, that annoys me. There's that one where you have to hear 250 of Risei's lines.
Yeah.
I don't even know how you get that. It's insane.
It's hard. There's a similar trophy in Persona 5 for, like, the Navigator character hearing a certain number of their lines. And I did end up getting that trophy in the Japanese version of Persona 5. And it is just, like, more or less dumb luck of being able to get that.
Yeah.
It's not just dumb luck. In Persona 5, it's a little bit easier because you have to use all of your different party members, and that's like the main way to try to get it is to maximize your potential for Risei or whoever to say different stuff is to just use all the different party
members
because there's different lines for all of them.
Yeah,
but you have to use them all extensively
because
they have to appear in different scenarios. So that's why Persona 5 does make it easier to do that one.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did anyway. Persona 4 is good. Some things in that game break down on a New Game Plus near the end when you are just like a walking god in that game. Like
that's not just a New Game Plus thing, my friend, if you're playing it the right way.
Anyway, it's crazy, but good game, obviously.
Yeah.
I had fun kind of. That was just a personal thing I needed to do at some point, and I finished it. I've now played both Persona 3 and Persona 4 twice, and I can kind of set that aside now, and I don't have that itch anymore of like, my Vita's over there, and it's got Persona 4 on it, and I want to play it again.
Yeah.
So now I've seen all the social links and stuff. It's good.
Did you do the like optional boss fight thing with Margaret at the end of that you can do on New Game Plus?
I'm probably going to go back and do it.
Yeah.
I had all the conditions set for it, and I like was kind of waiting through the true ending, like, when does that come up? And I kind of did some checking and stuff, and it never came up for me, and then I looked up, and it's a very obscure way to activate that. So I can go back and get it, and I probably will. But I had not done it yet.
Yeah, because that's like the one thing in Persona I've never really done because I've never actually finished a New Game Plus. Because every time I play one of these games again, it's a different fucking version of it.
Yes.
And that will continue for my entire life somehow.
Yeah, that will be fun for me. Persona 5 will be the first vanilla Persona I've played.
That's true, yeah.
Because I've played Fest and Golden and Portable, but never the vanilla versions of those games. So, kind of funny. Anyway, good games. Looking forward to Persona 5. Also looking forward to playing other games because Persona 4 kind of sucked me into a rabbit hole, as you can imagine. But I've been enjoying getting back on the horse with Gravity Rush 2. So that's my stuff. Do you have any stuff?
Yeah, I've got some stuff. I want to talk, like, go back to a bit of the Persona stuff because we both got the Persona 5 original soundtrack, which released in the past 2 weeks in Japan. And that got over here. And that soundtrack is really good. And I already knew it was really good because I played the game. But it's such a different experience, like playing the game and then versus you get the soundtrack. And this soundtrack is fucking huge. It's three CDs. It's like almost 4 hours of music. And like listening to that soundtrack kind of back to back and like going, being able to like go back to other songs and listen to them. In particular, at the last CD, which has some of the best songs in the game, and like getting to the end part of the game where there's a lot of like the original music that plays in the like last boss fight and stuff around that, and being able to sort of like listen to that back to back to back and really pay attention to it. Like there's a lot more going on with that soundtrack than I even like really noticed when I was playing the game, and that was really exciting, and I had this feeling I have not had in a couple of months now, where I was like, I so desperately need to talk about fucking Persona 5, and there's no person in this fucking country I could talk about it with.
Well, anyway, I have not played Persona 5, but I did get the soundtrack as well, and yes, it is amazing, and I specifically got it now, even though I would prefer to kind of wait so I don't have this thing sitting there that, you know, could potentially kind of spoil the game for me.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get it now because I was already getting a book from Japan, and I added it to the order because I'm not joking about this, I'm seriously worried about by the time April comes around, ordering things from overseas could be much more difficult. Yeah. So I thought, let's get this now and just have it. And it's a really cool soundtrack. Like, the packaging, it's got this great box, and then the big CD case, and the discs just have, like, it is as stylish as the game is, but in a fucking CD form. It's really neat. And it's a really cool soundtrack. I have specifically, you told me, avoid Disc 3, which I have, other than the last track, which is the short version of Wake Up, Get Up, Get Out There.
Okay, right, that's the opening movie version. Yeah.
Just to hear if there was anything different with it. And really, it's not.
You want to listen to the full version of that song. That was one of the most exciting things about getting the soundtrack, was to hear the full version of that song, because that's like the first time we've been able to hear that. Mm-hmm. And as with basically every single Persona opening theme song, the second verse is the best part of the song.
Yes, it is. That's true.
Like,
it's so weird.
I don't know why that's always... Maybe it's because... Like, they just have more time to work on it, so it's just like, they're like, let's just fucking tweak this thing and make it the best fucking second verse any song has ever had.
I really do want to say, so I have not listened to Disc 3, I've mostly avoided Disc 2, except for their version of the Tanaka song in this game.
It's good.
And I can kind of tell from what it is, what they're going for. I don't know what it is in the game, but I can imagine, and I love it. But I've mostly just stuck to the first disc, and specifically the two songs that I keep playing, and I've actually had to put a moratorium on playing, because I stop being productive when I listen to them, is Wake Up, Get Up, Get Out There, the theme song.
Yeah.
And then the... Life Will Change.
Life Will Change.
Is that the battle song, or what is that?
It comes up in a situation that does not exist in other Persona games. So it's like, I don't have... It's not the battle theme, but like it is a theme that plays at periodic points in the game.
Okay.
It's just like those... It does not have an equivalent like kind of theme in other Persona games.
But for those, like most listeners, I assume, who have not played Persona 5, Life Will Change is actually the song you hear in the big trailer they did last year that's like 4 minutes long.
Yeah.
That's the one playing under it. And those two songs... It reminds me of what Bruce Springsteen said about hearing Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone for the first time, that it blew open a door in the back of your mind you didn't know existed. That's what those two songs have done to me. And I'd heard parts of them before, but hearing the full versions of those two songs, which are like cousin songs, because Life Will Change is clearly like the sequel song to Wake Up, Get Up, Get Out There. And oh my God, those songs, Sean, those might be the two best like vocal songs I've ever heard out of a video game. Are unbelievably good. Like, they blow the doors off other Persona songs that I love, but it's like, I never thought you'd hear a battle-adjacent song, because that's what I was kind of assuming it was.
Sure,
but something like that like was more awesome than Mass Destruction?
Uh-huh.
These ones are.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't speak to something like the emotional impact of, like, the closing song of Persona 3, Memories of You, because these are not that. These are introductory songs. But, man, they just... And also, like, I got that soundtrack, like, right before the inauguration last week, and just to have, because those songs are very much, and I think that's the name of, like, the little CD is Songs of Rebellion. That's kind of what they sound like. I know that's the CD that comes with the box set in April here in Japan, in America, but that's what they sound like, because they are these songs about, like, shit is bad, wake the fuck up, people. And they are such great versions of that. The vocalist, Lin, who sings on these, is so fantastic. One of the best vocalists they've had with the Persona series.
Yeah.
And, man, those songs, Sean, like, the guitar and bass work on those songs.
The fucking, like, the bass guitar work on this soundtrack, like, that was a thing that I already really liked it, but then, like, being able to just, like, listen to it with my headphones and really be able to, like, pay attention to it. Like, because you don't even fucking know how good the fucking bass guitar is.
Oh, I know.
I mean, it's, like, those songs, it's very good, but, like... It's very rare, I feel like, for the bass parts to be, like, the star of a soundtrack. But for Persona 5, like, that is, the like, kind of the distinguishing feature. Because it is this, like, very acid jazz kind of genre that they're going for, the bass is so important to that.
God, I love it.
There are just some bass lines in this soundtrack that are unbelievable.
It's a great soundtrack. It's so cool to have.
Yeah.
You know, I would... If you're planning on playing Persona 5 and you want that soundtrack, again, I would kind of recommend on... ordering stuff that's an import sooner rather than later, and just you can let the soundtrack sit on a shelf until you're ready to listen to the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, I listened to those two songs that I was mentioning specifically so many times that I had to like specifically stop myself from doing it, because one, I was getting too excited for Persona 5 and couldn't do anything else with my life, and then it was also just like, those songs are so good, like I had trouble sleeping the night I got those because the song was playing in my head over and over. And when I, like, the way I listen to music is like an obsessive compulsive person. I listen to a song over and over and over over, and like, those songs reward it, but they get in your head. It's amazing.
Like, other things that are cool about that soundtrack is it comes with a little booklet that, one, has the official lyrics for all the
awesome
songs, which is very exciting for me for when we eventually get to do our podcast, that now I have a little booklet I can do for my beat poetry. And then also there's a lot of, for basically every single song on the soundtrack,
there's
a little note from Shoji Meguro and then some of the other like assistant composers that work with him, sort of talking about all the different music, and that it's particularly interesting for some songs. Again, like on disc 3, there's some recurring theme stuff they do near the end of the game that it's fun to see Shoji Meguro's sort of comments on how that came together.
That is one of the more detailed, like, liner note books that I've seen for a Japanese soundtrack.
Yeah.
Because it really clearly details who composed every track. It has the liner notes. It has, it has everything you would want if you wanted detailed information on this soundtrack. And you often don't get that, not just from Japanese games, but from any game soundtrack. Yeah. So that's really cool to have.
Yeah, because it is literally every single track on that soundtrack, which is a lot. Like, it's over 100 tracks. And so, yeah, that's cool. And it was the thing where, like, because the thing I had just couldn't hear easily for the longest time was the ending credits song to Persona 5, which was driving me crazy, because when I played Persona 3 and Persona 4, like, those soundtracks had been out for years and years and years, so, like, I could easily just go back and listen to those songs. And with Persona 5, it's like, if I wanted to listen to it, which I did this a couple of times, I had to load up my last save and, basically hurry through and just go, start playing the ending credits and just listen to that song. And now, that was the thing, having easy access to that and then the tracks that lead up to it and being able to see how that evolves. I got so excited that I literally loaded up my save from before the last boss in the game, beat the last boss again, just to see the whole end of the game from that point instead of from the point where, you kind of, go and talk to everybody for, the end and, talk to all your social link people and stuff. And, the end of Persona 5 is fucking amazing, but there's stuff about it that I didn't notice the first time I ended it that I like it even more now. It was
And the music kind of drove
it. Yeah, and the music kind of drives it. Because it's not just knowing the musical themes and the way it evolves in through those last sections of the game, but it's also knowing what the lyrics of the end credits song are, which it's all in Japanese. But there's one part in particular in that song that Shoji Meguro actually points out in his liner notes that's this really impactful line that comes with this really impactful part of the song. And that hit me so hard when that was playing on the ending credits the second time. It's a really good game.
Can I ask you one question about the ending of Persona 5?
Okay, go ahead.
So you said it does the social link thing where you can talk to people, is a thing 3 and 4 do. So 4 very much tries to mirror the ending of 3, and I actually on second, because I played Persona 4 first, then I played 3 twice, now I'm back to playing 4.
Yeah.
And one thing that I noticed is that I think the kind of shoehorning in at the end of certain Persona 3 elements to 4 worked for me a lot less, knowing Persona 3, and it felt like they were, that wasn't natural for that story. Do they find a better way to evolve that in Persona 5
at
the end?
Okay. Yeah, I would say so. It is structurally, Persona 5 is very similar to a lot of the Persona 4 stuff, but I do think they find ways to make it work a little bit better, because I think I know kind of what you're talking about with that sense with Persona 4.
There's just moments that are clear echoes of moments that from Persona 3, but when you start to think about it, in Persona 3, those moments work for a very specific narrative reason, and there really is no narrative rationale for it in 4. So I was just wondering, it's 10 years later, Persona 5, I assume they kind of moved past some of that.
So. And it's not just that they moved past it, it's something that a lot of stuff in Persona 5 has this sense of that team looking at the history of that franchise and their work, the Persona team's work on that franchise since 3, and then even some of the stuff from the people who worked on it beforehand, and kind of I feel like it develops those ideas, and it's something, again, where I think that there's some stuff they do with the very, very end of Persona 5 that very subtly kind of comments on the ways these games have changed and the way they've like the subject matter they've tried to tackle has changed. I think it does a better job at that stuff.
Cool. Can I talk about one other game soundtrack?
Sure, go ahead.
Because I never talked about this on the show, but the Persona 5 soundtrack is an awesome Japanese import. Another awesome Japanese import is the soundtrack to Final Fantasy 15.
Okay, yeah.
I have not talked about that yet. It is so cool. So I got the special edition from Japan. This was like a $90 soundtrack. And I understand if you're thinking I'm crazy for paying that much, but that game has really good music. So
yeah, and it's not just a Final Fantasy 15 soundtrack. It's like a Final Fantasy soundtrack.
Yes.
Right?
So what I should have brought it because I wanted to show it to you. But it comes in this big box that actually looks like kind of like a PS4, where it's like these two pieces, one that's like glossy black, one that's matte black, and it's just black, and it says like in tiny white lettering, Final Fantasy 15 soundtrack. But you pull the top off and there's all this stuff inside. So the special edition, just so you know, comes on Blu-ray discs, which you might think that's a little weird because you can't just put those in a computer and rip it, but they found a pretty cool way to do it. But anyway, so it's got two main Blu-ray discs in it. One you pull out and it's in this nice packaging and you kind of open it and it's like a Blu-ray case kind of thing. And it's the disc that is the Final Fantasy 15 original soundtrack. It's 90 tracks. On the CD version, it's 4 CDs, so if that would give you kind of an idea of the length. And I think it's about 5.5 hours long total, or close to 6. But anyway, I could check right now if I wanted to, but I'm not going to. But anyway, so you have that, and you can put it in your Blu-ray player and listen to it. And that's actually really cool because it's all in high fidelity, lossless audio. And the way it plays is for each track, they've put together like a video package of either kind of landscapes or gameplay from the game that kind of represents that track. So like the one, there's the song Wanderlust, which is the track that plays in Final Fantasy 15 during the daytime when you're just out wandering the open world.
Right.
And you probably know that one pretty well, although you might not know that it's fucking 6 minutes long, and you probably never heard the last 3 minutes of it if you played that game, because you would get into a battle or something.
Or you would be riding a fucking chocobo.
Right.
Because you're always riding a fucking chocobo, and you never get to hear that theme past, and, like, 12 hours into that game.
Or, like, the chocobo theme has a, like, minute-long intro that is not in the game that's really cool. There's all this other cool stuff about it. But anyway, so like you listen to Wanderlust, and it has this really cool video package of like your bros out on the road just wandering around the world and seeing cool stuff. And it's like, it made me really nostalgic for a game that when I got that soundtrack in late December, I had kind of just finished.
Yeah.
But I was like feeling really nostalgic. So it's really cool to watch and listen to it that way. But then also you can easily get the MP3s. What you do is you go to this part of the menu, which is like in both English and Japanese, so it's very easy to navigate. And it just gives you this little link, like you go to basically your IP address and it loads the MP3s and you can just download them as a zip file.
Oh, that's cool.
It's super cool. And they're 320 bitrate MP3s, so they're really good. But it was like super easy to get those off the Blu-ray disc, so that was awesome. And my brother actually has a Blu-ray drive, and he wanted to see if he could do this. You can also rip the lossless files off the Blu-ray disc pretty easily, and he found a way to do that, if you are so technically inclined. But you don't have to be. So that's really neat. That soundtrack, you know, the Final Fantasy 15 soundtrack is great. It is another one, though, like you were talking about with Persona 5. I don't think I fully appreciated how great and how complex that soundtrack is until I listened to the actual 90-track thing.
Yeah.
Because Yoko Shimomura went so far above and beyond, like, the Call of Duty for that game. Because, again, that Wanderlust track in no way needs to be 6 minutes long, but it is, and it's an amazing composition and just an amazing piece of music. And there are all these pieces that you'll hear that maybe you heard the full version of at some point in the game, but there's so much music in that game you couldn't fully appreciate it. And being able to fully appreciate it, like, there's this one track that plays when you are customizing the regalia, which I only did once in the game, so I didn't really notice it, but it's called Urban Chrome on the soundtrack. Nice. And it is such an amazing piece. Like, it sounds like it should be this, like, the theme song to a Top Gear-esque show or something. It is just so cool. Or like the theme that plays for Sydney, which you hear a couple times if you do her quest, but that's just an amazing track and things like that. So it is just a blast to listen to. That is an amazing soundtrack, and one of my favorites ever, you know, up there among my favorites for a Final Fantasy game, which is fucking saying something, because that is the series that probably has the greatest lineage of music in gaming. So, just an amazing soundtrack. But that's only one part of this special edition soundtrack they put out, because there's three other discs in the set. Two of them are CDs, and one is a CD of piano arrangements of songs. There's like 6 or 7 tracks, and they're really cool. Just little, kind of sparse piano arrangements of some of the big themes from the game. One of them, I think this was an Amazon Japan exclusive, but it was in the set and it was pretty cool. And it's all the tracks that played during the different trailers, dating back to like, I think the very first one for Versus 13.
That's a lot of trailers at some point.
Yeah.
So that is the game that had a long development history.
And some of those trailers had like unique music tracks, so that's why they put that together. But then the other big attraction of this special edition set is a Blu-ray that has all of the music, every single track you can get for the regalia in the game. So every little CD you get of like Memories of Final Fantasy III, Memories of Final Fantasy IV, it has all of them. And some of those I have the full soundtrack for, so I don't necessarily need it, but it's cool to just put that Blu-ray disc in. It has a navigable menu of every game you can listen to, and you go in and the tracks are there again in lossless high fidelity audio, which is so neat. And it is, if you look at like the time bar, over 15 hours of music.
God, yeah.
So this box set for Final Fantasy 15 has over 20 hours of music. And like approaching 24 hours of music.
Yeah, like you could almost literally spend an entire whole day just listening to that. And that was all you did.
Yeah, and it's
which
awesome.
Would be an insane thing to do, but kind of an amazing thing to do, I think, by the end of it.
Yeah.
You would come out of that experience a completely changed person, I think.
I think you would. And
you either love Final Fantasy more than anyone on the planet, or you would hate it more than anyone on the planet.
But it's just, it's really cool to see that just wall of like, and on this one Blu-ray disc, like here is 30 solid years of gaming history of, you know, some of the greatest music ever composed for this medium as it evolves up to now, and then you can listen to the whole Final Fantasy 15 soundtrack. That's just a really cool testament to game music. It also comes with a big art book that has, like, the track listing and everything. It's got notes from Yoko Shimomura.
Yeah.
Not Yoshi Shimomura. That would be a very different thing.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool if Yoshi also popped up.
And composed. Also. Yeah. They would be really annoying because they would be sung by the Yoshi choir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, no. Yoko Shimomura. It's also got an interview with her. I couldn't read all of that because I'm not that good with Japanese. But it is cool that it's all there and some of the art in there is neat. It's a really cool soundtrack. I don't know if you can still get it. I know you don't have to order it from Amazon Japan. I did that because I just frequently order from there anyway. But the Square Enix store in the U.S. is also selling them as an import item. It's a little more expensive because you're going through them, not just ordering directly from Japan. But if you love Final Fantasy 15 or just Final Fantasy in general, I think it's kind of a must-have thing. One thing to know is that Blu-ray with 15 hours of music, they do not have the same MP3 thing where you can just easily get those off of there.
Okay.
I don't really mind so much. Again, I have some of those soundtracks. I understand that would probably be a hard, tough order to figure out how to like arrange that for that easy download. You can, of course, put them in a Blu-ray drive and, you know, just get a program and rip them off, and you can do that, and that's fine. But I also kind of like that it's just something that if I wanted to do that, I'd like put it in my PS4, I'd sit on the couch, maybe have something else I'm working on at the time, and just kind of go through and pick different tracks.
Sure, yeah.
And it's all really nicely arranged. But it's a cool set. And man, last year was such a great year for video game music. This year is going to be just as good a year, it seems like. We are in, I tweeted this about Gravity Rush too.
Yeah.
I think we are in a golden age of video game music that has not existed since probably the Super NES Genesis era.
Yeah, no, like Gravity Rush 2 and Persona 5 like are two of maybe like the best video game soundtracks I've ever heard. And like I haven't even gotten to like listen to Gravity Rush 2's like entire soundtrack like freed from the game, but like even the pre-order bonus for Gravity Rush 2 for PlayStation 4 was you could get it's a download that is 8 tracks from the soundtrack. And they've done this in the past, like they did it with Last of Us and stuff like that you download to your PS4 and then you can just put it on a flash drive or whatever. And so even just like being able to listen to those 8 tracks and just listening to the music from the game, like the soundtrack to Gravity Rush 1 was already amazing, but Gravity Rush 2's music is just
it's out of this world.
It's a completely next level in some ways.
Yeah. But like I said this at the end of last year, 2016 had two of my probably top 10 soundtracks ever, and that's I Am Setsuna and Final Fantasy 15. And, you know, this year we'll have Persona 5, which will probably go on there.
Yeah.
Gravity Rush 2 might not be at that level for me, but it's an amazing piece of music. And just, there were so many other great soundtracks last year. I really do think there's just, and there's a lot of reasons for this, but I think video game composers are just doing some of the best work in this medium's history right now, and I think it's one of the most exciting things about this generation. More exciting than anything, like, technical to me, like the graphics and stuff. It's just the music we're getting with some of these games.
Yeah.
Out of this world.
No, yeah. Like, I was, when I was listening to the little CD, or not CD, but the little selection of music they give you to Gravity Rush 2, I was looking up the guy who's the composer for it, and I found out something that is not going to mean anything to you, Jonathan, but blew my fucking mind, is that he's the guy who's the composer for Mobile Fighter G Gundam, which is it has one of the best soundtracks any anime I've ever seen, and that's from like the late 80s or early 90s. And it blew my mind because I couldn't believe I had never made that connection, because it's the G Gundam soundtrack sounds so much like the Gravity Rush soundtrack in some ways. It was like, how have I never... It was that, and he also did the 08th MS Team soundtrack, which is another Gundam thing. It's like both of those just like, how have I never noticed it? Like, G Gundam was one of the few Gundam shows I actually watched as a kid because that was on Toonami. It's like... I've loved some of this dude's music literally my whole life. How did I not notice immediately that this was the same person? It would be like if someone grew up loving Star Wars and was like, oh, I love the Star Wars music so much, but like didn't really think much about like who made it, and then later in life discovered Indiana Jones. Or like, man, this Indiana Jones music is some hot shit. And then like 5 years after that, they're rewatching Indiana Jones and like, who's the guy who does this music? And find out it's the same guy that did Star Wars. Like, that's what it felt like. It was just like this weird, like two things that seemed disconnected in my life was like, oh, that's just the same thing. How did I not see that before?
Nice. Yeah. It really is. I think I was saying this off the air. Gravity Rush 2, you know, it plays, if you are in like Jira Paralau, the main like marketplace section, and you can be there for a long time, you'll just hear the same track looping. And at some point, you know, you would traditionally think, I'm going to get tired of this. And you don't.
No,
it's just even if I'm like listening to a podcast or something while I play Gravity Rush, which I do sometimes, I keep the audio at a level where I can still hear the music. Mm-hmm. Because it's relaxing. It's nice. I like having it there.
Yeah.
It's very good. So anyway, we've spent a lot of time on stuff. Let's go ahead and get to
stuff. I have one other bit of stuff that I do want to mention. I don't know how much I want to talk about it, but I feel like it's something we should bring up because it is something we kind of vaguely talked about earlier on an earlier podcast last year. And it just sort of came as a surprise to me that my dad wanted to watch Westworld because they have HBO. And I was like, okay, sure, I'll watch Westworld with you. And so we watched through Westworld, and that show's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is. It annoys me to my core because of the coverage of it.
I mean, it's nowhere near as good as it could be. Like, it's something that, like, the first couple of episodes of Westworld are really good when it is very much, like, centered on this, like, oh, this is a really kind of like that Edge of Tomorrow Tom Cruise movie. It's this very interesting way of taking concepts that are born from video games and trying to apply that narratively in a non-video game medium. And I find that really interesting. Westworld's all about like these people going into this town that's like a theme park that is just like a bunch of robots it's dressed up to be like the Wild Wild West. And then you just like kind of go there and do whatever you want and be whatever kind of person you want to be and shoot whatever you want to shoot and all that stuff. And the way the first couple of episodes are sort of positioned of, it's like, you know, these people go to this town and you hear one guy on the train being like, oh man, like last time I came here, I had so much fun. I just went total evil the whole way. And like, it was a very kind of, it sounded like someone talking about the way they played through Mass Effect or something. I thought that was really interesting. And then like around episode 3 or 4, the show just ends up becoming a really... Stop me if you've ever heard this one before, Jonathan. It's like a sci-fi show where there are robots, and the robots are very human-like, and then at some point they start slowly, because the robots are treated like slaves, but then eventually the robots start like gaining like humanity and self-recognition and cognizance, and then slowly they try to overthrow their human oppressors. Have you ever seen a sci-fi show or read a sci-fi book or seen a sci-fi movie that's done that, Jonathan?
Sounds vaguely familiar, but I don't know if I can put a finger on it.
Yeah, like because Westworld just starts doing that, and it just feels like... Because when it does that, it does it fine. Like, I think the show, it's just, like, it's really slow and it takes way too long to develop stuff, which is probably its biggest issue. But in general, I think it does the stuff it does fairly well. But it's like, there are so many things that do the, like, robot slaves get, like, sentience and try to overthrow their human overlords. It's like, how different are we really from the machines? And what is sentience, actually? It's like, all that shit. It's like, that's been tackled literally hundreds, thousands of times. It was like... But the actual premise you have of your Wild West theme park with androids and people going there and, like, telling stories in that theme park, that is something that literally only your show can do. So why wouldn't you have that be the point of your show instead of the, like, you know, basically doing something that dates all the way back to fucking Frankenstein, of, like, this whole religious allegory of, like, oh, we are God, but are we really going to be God? And they're like, blah, blah.
I'll say, it's the thing that probably will prevent me from ever watching Westworld is just that... I kind of expect more from HBO, and I don't want to sound like a snob about it, but it's just that I think that HBO at its best is more boundary pushing than that. And Westworld is boundary pushing on a like budget level, sure, but that's not what is interesting to me. And I do think if you look at like The Sopranos or Deadwood or something like that, they're great shows. The Wire are shows that like start out in a familiar genre and then blow that genre off its hinges. And nothing in Westworld seemed like it was doing that to me.
No, it doesn't. And, it could have, but it doesn't.
Yeah. And it's weird because there are shows on HBO right now that are much less popular, but do that, I think. Like, The Leftovers is just one of the best shows ever made, and it's uncategorizable, you know? And they have comedies like that at the moment. And so I think HBO is in a very healthy place, but it's just like, I'm kind of annoyed that they're so self-consciously trying to make a new flagship show.
Yeah.
Because even Game of Thrones, people forget, was kind of an organic flagship show, because when it started, no one knew if that thing was... Most people probably thought it wasn't going to take off, because it was this insane gamble.
Yeah.
And I think even Game of Thrones, on some level, even though it is much more probably commercial than some of those other shows I mentioned, it is something that takes familiar genre and plays with it, which is what the books did and stuff like that. So, anyway... Yeah, that's just the one thing that... But, I'm kind of curious about it from, like, a cultural level, but also there's 5 million great TV shows right now, and I don't...
Yeah. Like, if anything, I would say, like, watch the first episode of Westworld, because that's, by far, to me, that was the best episode.
Yeah.
Because it is... Like, what that just kept on getting me over and over again is the idea of, like... Like, stop doing this whole thing of the fucking robots becoming sentient. Like, I want you to do a whole story, just like a whole episode about a character, and explain to me why in this world a person who is obviously clearly very rich would pay a lot of money to go to a theme park where they can pay money to have sex with a prostitute that's actually a robot, instead of just paying money in the real world to have sex with a prostitute. Like, how is that the most important part of your fucking Wild West fantasy experience, of like the thing that you can just do? Like, if you want to have sex with a prostitute, that is readily available to you. It's been readily available to people throughout all of human history. You don't have to go to a fucking robot theme park to have sex with a prostitute. It's like, there's a lot of like weird issues like that that I wanted to, like, I want to know how they market the park. Like, I want to know how they monetize the park. I want to know, like, you know, what sort of like weird microtransactions of, like, you know, if you're super, super mega rich, you can buy the VIP pass that gets you like a super mega golden gun, and like you can have sex with anyone in the park you want without like having to go through quest lines and shit. Like, that is, to me, would be a way more interesting story, and they kind of hint at doing that stuff early on, and then they completely abandon it like halfway through.
It also, frankly, you know, as you're kind of skirting around the edges of this stuff, is that obviously these are all like moral play things they're doing.
Yeah.
It would be, it kind of, at a certain point when you're doing it all through robots, and as you say, but this is stuff that just exists in the real world, at some point I kind of don't want to see the allegory version of it anymore. I just kind of want to see the real world story about this, which also, if you want to see that on TV, you could watch like Starz' The Girlfriend Experience, which is a fascinating real world exploration of these things and off the beaten path. So I don't know.
Also, I want to just watch a show, or read a book, or watch a movie that is about like people interacting with robots, where the robots are just fucking robots at some point. Like, why can't, like, when was the last time you saw a thing that heavily featured robots where the robots were just straight up robots, and there was no moral issue about like how human are they? Like, are they sentient? Do they really feel pain? Like, who fucking makes that?
Star Wars: The Phantom Menace.
But like that's not about the robots, right? Like, it's not, because it's like I think it would be interesting in Westworld. Like, imagine if it was like there was no actual moral issue about like, are we inflicting pain on the robots because they are literally just machines that we dressed up to look like us, and it was just about like, well, who are these people? Like, why are they satisfied by having sex with this machine as opposed to real person, or shooting this machine as opposed to real person? Like that's, I think, an interesting area to investigate, like, that you don't have to go where to the same well everyone has ever gone before of like, what if the robots are really actually like humans? Because maybe it's just the place where we're at right now. The humanity is never going to get to the point where we make robots that are like, that can gain sentience. Like, that's never going to happen to us. We're never going to live for that long, but we are maybe going to hit the point where we can make like mass produced robots that are relatively lifelike on the outside. And those are stories we need to like think about telling,
more complex,
not about like them actually being humans, really, like Blade Runner.
We're gonna have more complex fleshlights, is what you're saying.
Exactly,
we are gonna. Yeah,
and I want the stories about those fleshlights, not about those, like, you know, fleshlights, but with a soul. Fleshlights with a soul, also the name of my new band.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's like the next big like book, like 50 Shades of Grey, that takes off.
Fleshlights with a soul. Yeah,
I can't wait to see that next Valentine's Day in theaters.
Yeah,
yeah. Anyway,
yeah. So that's my take on Westworld. Okay. It's an okay show. Watch the first episode.
All right, we have gotten so far off the beaten trail here, but let's go ahead and talk about some stuff. So Let's talk about some news. I think we buried this a little bit because I was reluctant to talk about it just because it makes me so sad.
Yeah.
The biggest news of the past 2 weeks in entertainment, I would say, and there have actually been some other people who have died, but just to keep it limited, I guess, John Hurt, beloved actor, passed away at the age of 77 this weekend. As some people rightly noted, he apparently saw 1984 happening right before his own eyes and decided, fuck it, I'm done, which I can understand. If you don't know, that's one of the movies he's famously in.
Yeah, he plays Winston, the main character in the movie.
I think until I saw this, John Hurt is one of those very few people, kind of like last year when David Bowie died, who I would put in this category of, like, I know in the back of my head this person is a human, and of course they can and will die, because that's what humans do. But I thought John Hurt couldn't die.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have been seeing him in things omnipresently since I was a little kid.
Yeah, he's in, like, every movie ever made at some point. Like,
but he's one of those rare actors who's, like, omnipresent, but in good stuff.
Uh-huh, yeah. No,
it's very, like, and he's just, you know, I think for a lot of kids of this generation, one touchstone is his small but notable role in, like, the Harry Potter movies. Mm-hmm. It's probably where a lot of people saw him for the first time, is in that first film, Sorcerer's Stone. His one scene in that movie is an amazing scene. Just it's one of those moments where Harry Potter would get a famous British actor, have them come in, hit it out of the park, and then exit stage left.
Yeah, or like if like the famous British actor would get served their papers of you have to be in a Harry Potter movie, and John Hurt got it out of the way early.
But, you know, so that's one, but all the way up to, I was just watching him, and I forgot he was in this, even though he's one of the best parts of the movie, in the movie Jackie, which came out, and one of the best movies of the year, also got not enough Oscar nominations. Anyway, Jackie, phenomenal, like, art, one of the best biopics I've ever seen, because it's an art film, not a cradle-to-the-grave narrative of this person, and John Hurt plays, basically, Jackie Kennedy's priest, who she goes and talks to about some of the very heavy things she's dealing with in her life, and John Hurt is just amazingly, like, soulful and emotional while also being quiet with it in there. And that's an amazing part. And I was just seeing people post all these pictures of his different movies, like, just recently, things like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy a couple years ago that he's amazing in, and again, a small part. But that dude was just the consummate character actor. He could come in, play a scene, steal the show, exit stage left, and just kind of own the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just, it's someone who I could never begin to tell you what my favorite John Hurt performance is, because it's just, he's John Hurt. He's bigger than all that. He's such an amazing actor. And I am so sad he's gone.
Yeah.
I forget every time that he plays the Elephant Man in The Elephant Man.
Uh-huh.
I forget that, because that is one of those performances that he is so, not just because of the makeup, but just because of the performance, he is so kind of both invisible and naked in that movie that you kind of forget an actor played that part.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, that's the thing that brought John Hurt to prominence, was The Elephant Man, and it's one of the great performances in not just a David Lynch movie, but kind of a movie of that era. He is so great, and yes, he played the Doctor at one point, and we're going to have to talk about that.
Obviously, we have to talk about that.
So many great things, and this saddened me so much.
Yeah, and for me, like thinking about the movies he's been in, is, like, he is, in the movie Alien, he's the guy who discovers the alien egg and then, like, attaches to him, and then eventually the alien bursts out of his chest, and if we did a new, like, top 10 movies episode of this podcast, which we did that years and years ago at this point.
I'd like to do that again if you'd...
Like, Alien might be in my top 10 at this point. It's probably... Or no, it must be my favorite horror movie, and I've seen it, like, 4 or 5 times at this point. Like, both out of just, like, curiosity and like, wanting to go see it again, and because it's come up in my classes when I was at college several times. And it is something where that movie is not really an actor's movie in a lot of ways, because it's not, you know, they're not playing, like, these really in-depth characters with, like, backstory and all this stuff. It's, nobody's giving, like, this really soulful performance in Alien, other than maybe Ian Holm as the android in that one, going back to the fucking robots again. But John Hurt, like, it's very easy to, like, look at that movie and think, like, well, anyone can kind of play that part, because it's, like, it's the dude who walks into the spaceship and gets killed. But that is that scene of him going in, and, like, everything about that whole scene of that movie, that is the linchpin of that movie, of the going into the spaceship and finding the egg. Like, that is by far the most important scene in that movie. It's the best scene in that movie. It's maybe the best scene in any horror movie ever made. Just, like, and a core part of that is his performance. And it's, like, it is, and it's one of the things that, like you say, like, John Hurt is the consummate character actor. He could play any kind of role, big or small, and give exactly what that role needed to have. And It was, like, honestly, when I saw him, the news that he died, the first thing I thought of was Alien. Like, and it's a weird thing, but, like, that is the performance, because it is a relatively small performance, but it is so critical to that movie, and it is such an amazing movie that is, like, it just, like, that, for whatever reason, that was the first thing that popped in my mind, even before Doctor Who.
I mean, it's so weird for an actor to be this prominent where I struggle to think of a movie where he is truly the lead. The mm-hmm. closest is something like The Elephant Man. And even then, if you're being technical, the protagonist of that movie is kind of the guy from Westworld, Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, yeah.
The Anthony Hopkins character, because he's kind of our point of view into that story. And even then, his role is a little bit limited in that film. And that, to me, sometimes those are the best actors. It's not the person who you see on the poster for every movie, but it's the guy who could come in and just make the movie with a scene.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, Alien is a great example of that, because what more prominent scene can you think of than that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just looking at his list of credits, and just, like, going backwards through it, it's like every year or two, I just see a movie with him I loved. Like Jackie this year, Snowpiercer in 2013. He's right, yeah. Just a small role. Great. Only Lovers Left Alive, the vampire film by Jim Jarmusch. I love his role in it. Very small, but he's great. I talked about Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Melancholia. I forgot he's in that. It's just, it goes on and on, and I'm just going backwards. He's in the Hellboy movies.
Yes.
I forget
yeah.
about that. He was one of the best parts of the shitty Indiana Jones 4.
Okay, yeah.
Right? He's yes, pretty yeah. good in that movie. V for Vendetta, where he basically replayed his role from 1984. He was actually really... That's yeah. the one thing I remember about that movie, is Hugo Weaving being annoying with alliteration and John Hurt being pretty genuinely creepy.
Yeah.
You know, and I could just go on and on, because you look at this list, he has over 130 film credits. We're not even looking at TV. And just, it's incredible. He was the narrator in the Tigger movie. Not that that's an important yeah. one, but I just, like, look how ubiquitous that is.
Yeah, I mean, it is insane to think about, like going all the way back to, like, Alien and before that, and then up to now yeah. with movies like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and Jackie, that's like...
He did the thing yeah. in Spaceballs where he replayed the scene where he dies.
Yeah.
And that's a hilarious scene in Spaceballs. And I love that they got actual him to do that. Boy, this actually makes sense. I've forgotten he's the voice of the Horned King in the Black Cauldron.
But, okay,
that makes sense, given his voice. But just, you look at these, and yeah, Alien and Elephant Man were 1 year apart.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
amazing.
I didn't realize that.
He's Aragorn in the animated Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
I did not know that.
Really?
Yeah. That's crazy. Huh. That's good casting.
Yeah.
I just didn't know it. And that was just before he kind of got famous with all that.
Fuck
but,
yeah, now that you say that, and I think about... Because I've seen that movie more than people probably should, because it's not that good. But
yeah,
no, that is definitely him.
And I'm looking at his TV credits. There's a bunch of great ones there, too. But, of course, one of the most recent ones is Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I just want to say really quickly, you know, that is another one that is kind of a defining role of John Hurt for me. Both because we're Doctor Who addicts, but also it kind of... He is so great in that 50th anniversary special. You can pretty much ignore that the writing to make him the Doctor is not Stephen Moffat's finest hour.
Yeah.
But it kind of doesn't matter, because John Hurt comes in, and by the end of that 1 hour, you kind of feel like, yeah, I can buy that guy as the Doctor.
Yeah, like that whole 50th anniversary special, which is a, like, really great thing, and, like, every time I've gone back to see it, like, I like that 50th anniversary special more and more. And the main reason that that is the case is because of John Hurt. If it was not for him and his performance, that thing would have completely fallen apart. And
oh, absolutely.
Like, there's still, like, a part of me that is holding on to, like, what if Paul McGann had had that role and stuff like that, which would have been cool. But it is, like, so the fact that John Hurt, who's somehow has never been in an episode of Doctor Who, even though, like, his acting career has been basically the length of Doctor Who, like, that he could come onto the show he's never been before, play the lead character for this TV show that, fuck, even, like, talking about it starting in 1963, like, at that point it had been on for, like, 7 seasons, right? Like, the seven-season TV show where he has to come on out of nowhere and play the main character from that show, like, before, chronologically, before all these other actors that have been playing him for years, and play alongside those actors that have been playing that character for 3 years.
And be the emotional linchpin of that episode.
And have to show how old Doctor Who becomes new Doctor Who and be that transitionary figure when having literally never been involved in the show before in his entire life. Like, that is an insane task to ask of any actor, and the way he blows that part out of the fucking water is unbelievable to me still today. That every time I go back and watch that 50th anniversary special, his performance is the thing that, like, I look to every time to, like, see more of it, right? Yes. Like, you see more of the depth of what is going on with the character and the script and the story and all of that. It comes through from him more than anyone else because he's given such this crucial role and he plays it so perfectly.
Did you ever listen to the Big Finish drums?
I haven't gotten around to them yet.
I feel guilty that I never have.
Yeah.
Because now I really want to, and it's sad that they're never going to get to do more of that because I'm sure that was the plan. But
yeah, there are two, because there's two box sets that have been released, and then there are two that he also recorded that have not come out yet. Okay. So I'll probably end up listening to them once they're all out.
And that's the thing. He was so prolific. We actually, there's more Big Finish stuff. There's also, just looking, he's like six movies that haven't come out yet.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure he's phenomenal in all of them. But it's just, man, there are a few that would hit me harder than John Hurt. And I don't, again, because I hadn't even thought of the possibility that this man could die, it really took me aback.
Yeah.
Because as a lot of British people do, like David Bowie and Alan Rickman last year, he didn't tell anyone about this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. His family, I'm sure. But, like, publicly, we didn't know. And it was very out of the blue. And that's very sad.
Yeah.
So, we love you, John Hurt. We will be talking about your work a lot in the future,
yeah.
You know, because man, you start talking about enough movies or TV shows, you're gonna come up on him, and
yeah,
love him. So yeah, John Hurt, best wishes to his family and everything. It's sad.
Yeah,
let's go ahead and talk about some silly news.
Okay,
all right.
I need some silly news, Jonathan. Let's talk about something silly.
Let's talk about some Nintendo stuff.
Okay,
all right. So last time on this podcast, which was 2 weeks ago, we talked about the Nintendo Switch unveiling that they did and all that stuff. And we're 2 weeks past that, and no pre-orders have been canceled yet. So we seem to be okay, but we'll
see. They're going to switch it out on you in the last second, Jonathan.
If they canceled the pre-order by having a little video where the guy said, "Now we're going to switch, you get a Wii U," or something like that.
Like, what if that is the whole point of the name the entire time? Like, the Nintendo Switch has never existed. It's just the biggest con in the history of the human race.
Well, that would be... Nintendo likes their puns, you know?
It's like, the Switch! It's a Wii U, and we're dissolving the company, fuckers. Zelda's never coming out. Fuck you. It was never real. They're all doctored videos.
That would be interesting. You know, it's just like, we've actually had Miyamoto in a cell for 3 years. Yeah. Just chained up, making him make Mario Maker levels.
Yeah.
Anyway, no. All right, but let's follow up on that a little bit. Some more details did come out, specifically about Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
One of the questions we and a lot of people had is, what is the specific difference between the Nintendo Switch and Wii U version?
And that's the sound quality.
That's one part of it, but it was specifically confirmed. On the Wii U, it'll run at 720p, 30 frames per second, which actually indicates how taxing this game might be, because I don't know of any other first-party Wii U games that run below 1080p. I mean, that games on that system generally chug at the highest they can, so that's kind of interesting. Versus the Switch version, which will also be 30 frames per second, but at 900p, so still not up to 1080p, and that's for the docked version, of course.
Yeah.
On the screen, it'll be 720p. I mean, a lot of games you play these days are actually in 900p, especially if you play on an Xbox One, so not particularly surprising, but that's the difference.
It's the difference between Assassin's Creed 4 on the PS4 at launch and Assassin's Creed 4 on the Xbox One at launch.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, we have that, and then there is a sound effect difference where they've said, basically, environmental sounds, there will be more of them and they'll be better on the Switch, which just indicates that that's probably a processing thing. That
it's probably just like the tech underneath the Switch is like, oh, we have like this like sound processor thing that's like, it just does this a little bit better.
Yeah, so who knows?
It was just like a weird thing. You just don't see people talk about that, of like, oh, the sound effects on this version are a little bit better.
I liked the transparency of them saying that, because normally I think you wouldn't even mention it.
Yeah, it would just be something that's like, well, okay, sure. Yeah.
So, you know, I think you can probably safely play this on the Wii U, and you're not, it's not like it's running at 10 frames a second. I don't know. You don't really go more than 30.
Yeah.
But, you know, but also on the Switch, it is, you know, like one notch higher or something.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. So it kind of makes sense, obviously, with what those are. They also confirmed that Breath of the Wild will be their last first party title for the Wii U. You could probably guess that, but it is interesting to just hear that total confirmation of, yes, we haven't released a first-party title since, like, Paper Mario Color Splash in September.
This and that was, like, the only one we released that year, so...
Yeah, but that's it for the Wii U. And, you know, they said specifically first-party. I don't know what third-party games are going to be coming out either.
There's probably some, like, weird, like, Ubisoft party game or something.
Sure.
Just Dance 2019 is probably still going to come out on the Wii U somehow.
Sure, but I just, you know, in terms of anything notable, the Wii U is definitely, that is their confirmation that it's coming out for people who have stuck with it.
Yeah.
But it is, that is a dead system walking.
Yeah.
Or a completely dead
system? It's a dead system buried in the ground. Okay, yeah. That you can, like, you know, stick an HDMI cable through 6 feet of dirt to play Legend of Zelda when that comes out if you want to.
I was playing my Wii U today a little bit. I'm working on one topic I want to do before the Switch comes out is a little Wii U retrospective. Sure. And the one game on that I hadn't played that I do want to play is, ironically, the launch game. I've never played New Super Mario Bros. U.
Oh.
So I finally got that off eBay because for some reason, new copies of that game are still $59.99.
Because people who are sitting around being like, Nintendo's going to price drop all this stuff is like, they did that with the 3DS under very special circumstances. Nintendo never price drops fucking anything.
No, they do that Nintendo Selects thing now, but that's like as a specific, like,
yeah.
They used to do that with like Player's Choice, so they've always done that. But yeah, so anyway, I got a good deal on it. I really like that game. I'll talk about it later, but I've just kind of been, like, when I need a little break from Gravity Rush, because that's a game I like to play kind of like a fine wine.
Sure,
take it in, but you can't just binge it for like 6 hours in a row.
No, yeah, yeah.
I play a little Mario U, and that's kind of fun. Just I wanted to get a little taste of that, so I was playing my Wii U today a little bit. Let's see. They also put out a website, or uploaded to the Nintendo Switch website, I should say, full specs for everything. So you can explore the console. You can say, you know, what are the dimensions and weight of the Joy-Cons and the dimensions and weight of the console itself and all this different stuff. What specifically are some of the resolution specs, which we did pretty much know, but they have specific confirmation of all those. So you can explore those. I think some interesting things are that even with the Joy-Cons attached, the Switch itself is pretty light. It's less than a pound, which is interesting because that's pretty much the weight of, like, the modern iPads. And I would have expected, just because of the tech inside this thing, it to be a little heavier. It sounds like they kept it pretty light, which is nice for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, everything else was pretty expected. One thing I did see some people point out is that the headphone jack on the Switch console itself, people noted, on Nintendo's website it says headphone/mic jack.
Yeah, so it does technically have support for a microphone.
So does that mean you can also do voice chat through the system?
Who knows?
We have no idea. Yeah. There is an awful lot we don't know about that system that's coming out in a month. That's a little weird.
I thought one weird thing that, like, Kotaku had, like, a fact thing that they have, like, a bunch of questions they sent Nintendo, and mostly they got answers back of, like, we're not talking about that yet. And one, like, answer that they got that was, like, a little bit weird to me while we're just talking about Switch stuff is that there's not going to be any video apps at the launch of the
Switch.
That is
a bizarre thing.
Yeah, like which is no Netflix, no YouTube. In particular, I wish I had the article up, but it was like the specific answer they gave was something like, there will be no video apps available at the launch of the system, and we will consider them in the future, which is like, I thought it was like, you would expect that was maybe like, oh, they're like, it's still in development, like, they're not ready, they'll come at like some point. It's like we will consider them in the future. Was, I don't know if that was just like weird business speak or like a weird translation from the Japanese or something, but it was just like, that's a strange answer, because surely they're going to be like, fucking My Shoe plays Netflix at this point, right? Like, there's no world in which the Switch does not get a Netflix app at some point.
I mean, yeah, the 3DS plays every video app under the sun, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's the 3DS. Why would you want to watch video on it? Yeah. But you can play Netflix. I think Crunchyroll's on the 3DS. It's insane.
I would not be surprised, yeah.
Yeah, but you can get... So, you know, I think it's weird just because... Probably all you have to do is say to Netflix, and probably what you want at launch is Netflix and YouTube. I understand you don't have every app at launch.
Yeah,
no console does. But you at least probably get Netflix and YouTube, and probably all you have to say is, we want your app. Here's our, like, detail.
Yeah, you send them a dev kit, and then they make the app for it. Like, because as far as I understand, that's just how it works.
That is in Netflix and YouTube's best interest, is
yeah.
So they will do that in a heartbeat. So it's just... Again, if they had just said, it just wasn't ready for launch, we'll get it, I wouldn't really bat an eyelash at it. You're right, it is the, we'll consider it. It's like... You're gonna have it unless you're crazy.
Yeah.
Because it's a cool portable, like, tablet-esque system. That is like the number one system you want Netflix
exactly.
on.
Like, as someone who doesn't own an iPad or other tablet device, like, that legitimately would be a, like, nice feature of something I would look to for, like, the Switch of, like, oh, hey, this would be a good thing of on, like, an airplane or something. I could buy their Wi-Fi shit and, like, stream a Netflix movie on that. And, like, that would be way more preferable over doing that on your phone, obviously.
Right. So, kind of bizarre, but... You know, Nintendo has both weird corporate speak and sort of that weird Japanese stiffness in how they talk about stuff, where they're very reserved, and you often get weird answers like that. So, yeah, I don't know. They need to, like, talk to a speech therapist and learn how to open up, you know? But yeah,
just get a little bit off the cuff, especially when you're talking about Netflix and YouTube apps. It's like, come on, of course they're going to be there. Just like, don't give an answer that makes it sound like there is a possibility, which it doesn't, because it makes everyone a little bit weirdly nervous. It's like,
yeah.
is there like something weird about like the way the Switch is built that it just can't stream video? Because there's no way that that's possible. But the way you answered that sounded like that was a possibility, and it's making me uncomfortable.
Like you have to patch it into the UI or
exactly,
something.
Exactly. Yeah, like the big Netflix patch of 2018.
So it is a weird thing about it. So yeah, but Nintendo's got a Nintendo.
Yeah, they have Nintendo-like solutions for their problems.
Yeah. So anyway, those are all the details we have on the Switch right now. Let's see. I'm leaning more and more towards I want the Neon Joy-Con unit.
Okay.
I just think those look cool. I think
those look cool, like separated. I think like blocked onto the thing. It looks a bit garish to me.
Yeah. I have one of each pre-ordered because one's also going to go to my brother.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
But I have a month to decide, and we're gonna.
Should do is you and your brother should decide like which one you want, blue or red, and then take that one, and then have to put the black one on the other one.
That'd be funny.
I mean, because nobody's going to have a Switch that looks like that.
I think that would work, too, because the way they sync, it sounds pretty easy. You just put it on the thing, and it automatically syncs, and it probably doesn't know they're a left-right pair.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very excited to get this thing and just explore it and see what it is and talk about it on the show. I mean, I could bring the fucking Switch to the podcast and be playing it while we're talking about it.
That would be a bad idea, but you should bring it.
Yeah, at least so you can see it.
But you shouldn't play it.
Yeah, no. I'd get distracted, probably. Yeah. I'll be playing my Puyo Puyo Tetris. Which is one of the games I'm most excited for, actually. That game
looks
cool.
Okay, sure. Yeah, no, I've heard it's very good.
Alright, so that's Nintendo Switch stuff. Nintendo also did an extra Nintendo Direct later that week, which was the Fire Emblem Direct. And, you know, some assholes online were being sarcastic, like, why are they making so many Fire Emblem games? And to those people, I say, fuck you! 4 years ago, this series was dead, and they were about to cancel it, and we are now in a position where Fire Emblem is one of Nintendo's most profitable and popular franchises, and if you can't recognize how that is amazing, you have no soul, my friend.
Yeah, you're probably sitting around and still waiting for them to start making Metroid games again, you asshole. We want to be buried in Fire Emblem. Drown me. Bury me with my Fire Emblem.
It's just, this is not the kind of series that gets this kind of resonance, renaissance this late in its life. It is so awesome to me, and what's most awesome is, so they announced four games. It was actually a pretty cool direct, and it reminds you that when Nintendo isn't doing stuff live, but like their pre-packaged directs, they're really good at this. They do really, like this one was narrated in English by Yuri Lowenthal, which was really cool. He's a good voice actor. And it was just a fun like 20-minute presentation, and it's like, yeah, they probably should have just done something like this for their Switch unveiling, because most of the problems with that reveal were the weird live elements that just didn't work. So anyway, it was fun. They announced four games, and I love kind of the breadth of these games. Like, none of them are like the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we're getting, first off, a new 3DS game on May 19th called Fire Emblem Echoes Shadows of Valentia.
Okay, which is a remake of like Fire Emblem Gaiden or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Fire Emblem Gaiden, which was the second game in the series, came out on the NES. So, to people in Japan, this is a remake. To everyone else in the world, this is a new game, because that game never went outside of Japan. And even in Japan, I mean, this isn't a full remake. This is in 3D. It's using the Fire Emblem Fates engine. It looks pretty cool, so it'll be like it's new.
Yeah.
And I'm just excited, because like, normally Fire Emblem is the kind of series you've got to wait a couple years to get a new game.
Yeah, yeah.
But we just had Fates last year, and I'm getting a new 3DS Fire Emblem.
Like, not this May. Just saying you got Fates last year is like so underselling it, because you haven't even fucking finished that game, really.
No, because there's three campaigns, and I played two of them. Yeah.
You got Fates 1, 2, and 3 last year.
It would be like if they announced Persona 6 was coming out next year or something.
Exactly, yeah. Persona 6 and then like a full ground-up remake of Persona 1 on the Persona 5 engine or something.
Yeah,
it would be fucking amazing.
It's just really cool. And like, as a 3DS owner, I am so psyched for that. And, you know, May 19th, I'm so excited. That is going to be such an awesome thing, because I really have always wanted to play some of those early Fire Emblem games, and there's not actually a lot of Fire Emblem games out in English.
Yeah.
There's the two GBA games, the GameCube game, the Wii game, and the DS one, which is a remake of the first NES game. So it seems like they're finally kind of getting that started up again, of doing DS-adjacent remakes of the original games.
Yeah.
And that one actually just came out on Wii U, they released, DS remake, so you can get that there. I have never played it, and I don't have a cart, so I will probably get the Wii U Virtual Console version of that.
I feel like we are a far cry from the days when Super Smash Bros. Melee came out, and Roy and Martha, and everyone's like, who the fuck is Roy and Marth? Because even the Fire Emblem games that they released over here didn't have Roy and Marth in it. It was like the sequel to the one that had Roy, which was technically a prequel to the one that had Roy.
Well, and
the
Marth
one was way older than that.
And that was only released because of Melee.
Yeah.
It was such a hit, and people were like, we love these characters, what are they from? And those had never
come
out.
It's like, well, here's the one dude's dad, Elwood. Like, yes. Like, congratulations, we're not going to give you the one with the character from fucking Smash Brothers in it.
It's so cool. So I just... This is the one I'm most excited for of these because it's the one like we have the most info on. But that's awesome. I, you know, like this is one I'll totally freely consider for like my top 10 because technically it's a remake, but we never had this game, so it's new to us.
Sure, yeah.
And it looks like a really cool Fire Emblem game, and I'm so psyched, and it looks great. And it's coming. It's just another case where Nintendo at its best. They made the game, they didn't say anything about it, and only when they were fucking done, they show it like it's coming in May.
Yeah,
great. You don't even have to wait. I love it. So they had that. They
you
did
have
announce,
to finish Fire Emblem Face by then.
I don't know if I can. I have too many other JRPGs. There's going to be Persona 5 before then.
Yeah,
I will
admit,
get on it. I don't get JRPG'd out that easily. After playing Persona 4, I'm glad I'm playing Gravity Rush, which is such a radically different game.
Yeah.
I need to decompress. Because I went off like Final Fantasy 15 into this.
So right, yeah.
You know, Yeah, I need a recharge period. But anyway, they also announced that the main Fire Emblem team is making a new, like, full Fire Emblem game for the Nintendo Switch. They're thinking 2018. They weren't, like, there were no details on this, obviously, because it's in development. But if nothing else, this is cool because this is actually our first hard confirmation of one of the mobile teams, like one of the 3DS teams, moving over to the Switch. I want to say switching over.
Yeah, yeah.
Moving over
you,
to the
just go ahead and do it. It feels so good.
Switching over to the Switch to make their next big game, and that's awesome, I think.
Yeah.
So the team that made, you know, Awakening and Fates, their next one will be for the Switch, so it'll be a, you know, our first real, like, home console Fire Emblem since the one for the Wii that you can't get because it's, like, $200 on eBay. since that one. But on the Switch, you can also take it on the go and stuff. And I love that because Fire Emblem works great on mobile and it's awesome. But it would also be cool to see, like, their graphics are so great in Awakening and Fates. I'd love to see what they can do with, like, a full home console.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. And I'm, you know, they didn't have anything to show, but I'm glad we heard that because that's frankly something I would have liked to hear at the main Switch event because that was one of our complaints. Is there any indication of 3DS teams moving over? Well, there you go.
Yes.
That's pretty good confirmation. So we have that. Fire Emblem Warriors is coming fall 2017. That's the game they announced sort of at the Switch event. It's the one that is like Hyrule Warriors, Dynasty Warriors.
Yeah. In that Samurai kind of Warriors.
Dragon Quest Heroes kind of thing.
Berserk game that's coming out. There's another one. There's like a big crossover one that's a bunch of Koei Tecmo franchise characters crossing over. They've released like five of these Musou games in like the past 2 years. I'm kind of concerned for the people making these games.
But yep, we get that, and it's coming this fall. It'll be a Switch game. It will also be on the new 3DS.
Which, that was the thing that was kind of like the most interesting piece of news about it, out of this, was like, it had never really occurred to me that a cross-3DS, cross-Switch game would exist.
And it's kind of, it makes sense in so much as Hyrule Warriors, which was the same team made that, also wound up having a 3DS port.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the infrastructure is there, it's kind of like, why not do it?
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is it's new 3DS specifically because Hyrule Warriors Legends, the 3DS version, ran like shit on the base 3DS from all indications. I haven't played it, but that's what I heard. So that's kind of interesting. That it's like the third new 3DS exclusive game. So we have that. But they actually showed footage of gameplay, which we didn't see at the Switch event. And I thought it looked cool. I have not played one of these games.
It looks like a Musou game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, this is the series I'm an actual big fan of. So I think I will totally play this. And this sounds like a fun thing to spend time doing.
If they put Lubu in it, I'll check it out.
Okay. But I did enjoy just seeing Crom from Fire Emblem Awakening just go crazy on some bad guys.
Yeah.
And it looked neat. So again, it's kind of like Hyrule Warriors. You look at it and you're like, I don't know how you get that thing running on the 3DS, new or old. There's a lot of things on screen.
Yeah.
But apparently they did it, as long as you were on a new 3DS, it works fine.
Yeah.
So I got that one for my brother for Christmas last year, I think, and he likes it. So he's just like, it's not, you know, a full Zelda game, but it was tiding him over until the next one. So
yeah.
All right. So we have that. And then their last announcement, and this is what they spent the most time on, is Nintendo's next mobile game following up Super Mario Run is Fire Emblem Heroes.
And you will get Fire Emblem Heroes and Fire Emblem Warriors. You will get those two titles mixed up for the rest of your life.
Yes, you will. And this will be coming to, sort of looks like it's coming to Android first, but they haven't really confirmed where it's going, and it sounds like it's not going to be the same kind of wait between iOS and Android for Mario Run. It'll probably be a shorter window, but it does look like Android users are getting this first. But it looks really cool. Like, it actually reminds me a lot of Super Mario Run in terms of this looks like a smart adaptation of this series for mobile.
Yeah.
It looks like it's more on the free-to-play zone, where Mario Run you just pay for once and you have it. This does have some free-to-play, like, microtransaction-y elements, but it doesn't look, at least from the surface and everything they showed, like it's too overbearing. But it's like a basic, you've got your grid, and it is sort of a tactical RPG thing, but like a miniaturized version of that. And you collect heroes, and you put them into battle. And it looks like a lot of fun. Like, I think Nintendo hit it really out of the park with Super Mario Run. And I love that Fire Emblem is the one that follows fucking Mario.
Right. Yeah.
That's amazing, you know? Pokemon Go really face-planted, but it looks like the actual in-house Nintendo mobile games are there's a lot of love and care, it looks like to me.
Yeah, like, I was really excited about it at first, but I feel like the more I've heard about Fire Emblem Heroes, the, like, more reticent I'm getting about it. Just in that, like, in my imagination, I would want a Fire Emblem mobile game to be more like Super Mario Run, where it's like, just, I would totally pay $10 if you just put out, like, it's just Fire Emblem.
Right.
That's just on iPhone, because there's no reason why you couldn't do that. Like the interface of those games is not such that you need, like, buttons and D-pads and stuff. Like, you could play a game like that with a touchscreen interface. And it seems like they're turning it into what is called a gacha-type game, which is that kind of game where you buy heroes with money and, like, level them up and, like, get currency to unlock more heroes and stuff. And it's just, it looks like everything in the game is, like, pared down and stuff like that. And you're not going to get, like, the full, like, feel the battle and, like the whole story mode and all that stuff that you would want from a main Fire Emblem game. And as someone who has, like, experimented with a lot of these gacha games that are really popular in Japan and then a lot of, like, Asian territories, like, the free-to-playness of those, at first it seems like, oh, this is perfect, and you play, like, 3 to 4 hours of it, and then slowly the free-to-playness of it gnaws at you until eventually you realize, like, I can't do anything with this game without paying money. And, like, I just, like, and it's, there's a good chance that they will find a much better sort of, like, way to sort of change that progression loop and stuff like that. But it does, like, I became a lot more hesitant about it after, like, reading more about the details.
And I guess my only exposure to it was the direct presentation. Yeah. I don't know anything about gacha games. But, yeah, you know, it could be kind of middling. We'll see what it is.
Like, I just think, like, you should keep your expectations medium, because if you have your expectations really high and hope it's, like, a Fire Emblem game level stuff, I think you might be disappointed.
But I don't. I mean, because we're getting plenty of real Fire Emblem games, and it's also, like, I kind of like it in the Mario Run model, where I don't think Mario Run qualifies as, like, a full Mario game.
Sure, no.
But I like it as kind of a miniaturized approximation of things I like about Mario, and it looks like Fire Emblem Heroes doing that could be the same kind of thing on mobile. Because I think, you know, even though Fire Emblem, you're right, is probably the Nintendo series that would be best suited to a touchscreen, because you don't necessarily need buttons for everything. I still, you know, I just don't play, like, in-depth games like that on my mobile phone. So. Yeah,
but, like, as someone who doesn't own a 3DS, like, I would be so stoked. Like, fuck it, like, just put out Fire Emblem, like, the GBA Fire Emblem game, like, on the phone with an updated interface so that it works on its fucking touchscreen, and I would pay $10 for that happily.
Yeah. You know? You can get a Wii U and you can get it for $7.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I pay the, like, fucking, like, $300 it costs to get a new Wii U.
I'm just joking.
Yeah. But anyway. I will say I was very, very happy with their, like, full gameplay trailer and all that stuff. Had extensive footage of Lindis from the GBA Fire Emblem.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, like, that was the thing I was waiting for, like, you have all of your big crossover characters, and I was thought they were going to, oh, they're just going to fill this with fucking Awakening and Fate's assholes, because those are the big popular ones. And then Linda showed up, and I was like, okay, great.
They actually had a pretty good mix. Yeah. Like, I was impressed. They haven't forgotten their roots. Although, so
their chibi animation for Lindis's critical hit attack, though, did not really do it for me. So that kind of that was a bummer.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, how cool was it to have just a whole Fire Emblem Direct, and, like, they are really investing in this fucking series. I love it. Now, if we can just get one of those for, like, Metroid someday again.
It's never going to happen.
I know, but
it's Metroid, Star Fox, and F-Zero, the fans of those Nintendo franchises give up. It's never becoming a thing again. It was never really a thing in the first place when you look at the sales.
But sales-wise, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a weird, yeah. Too bad.
Yeah.
I think they could make it work, damn it.
They could. They just have to try a little bit harder than Other M.
They could. You know, I really do think the way the gaming landscape has changed since, like, Metroid Prime 3, I do think you could bring Metroid back and make it a bigger commercial success.
No, absolutely. I just think Nintendo's
probably not
going to do it.
Probably not.
It sucks.
But it's just, like, if you did it in the model of Metroid Prime, where you gave it to a really smart kind of outside studio and said, have at it. And I think, especially in this day and age, when I think, frankly, critical reception matters more than it did 20 years ago, 10 years ago.
That was one of the big stories of game sales last year, was that first day sales are not as important as they traditionally have been. That is, like, you want a game that has a longer tail on its sales.
I mean, imagine if Metroid Prime 1 came out in the era of, like, Let's Plays and stuff, and people could play it, where they just walked through it and it was so... Because that's such a cool exploration-based game. That would sell like hotcakes today if you had that kind of... If Nintendo embraced online sharing and stuff, as they might be doing with the Switch, we'll see. And you could really get into that, like, online. I think it could be the kind of series that could be a big asset, but it's also a series that takes an incredible amount of time and money and work, and I can't necessarily blame Nintendo for not doing it, but it also makes me sad.
I'll just sit here waiting for my Star Fox Adventures 2 that everyone wants.
One day they'll get Rare to come back to Nintendo.
Exactly. And they'll buy them away from Microsoft. It's like, hey, we've got you again. It's just
you
time.
Fuckers are
more dinosaurs, goddammit.
Did Fox, like, fuck a dinosaur in that game? I don't
know. He fucked another fox. A blue fox lady named Crystal, I think her name was.
That's really disappointing, because interspecies stuff is where these games tend to go. Like, Mario's gonna, fuck a... I guess Mario is a human, but he's a chibi human.
Well, I guess I don't know if she was specifically a fox. She may have been some other sort of canine. I don't know.
She could have been a wolf.
Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah. Anyway, a domesticated dog.
Yeah, let's stop talking about this.
All right. Let's move on to some other fun stuff. Logan, the new final Wolverine movie...
Yeah.
We talked about how much we loved the first trailer for that. They put out a second trailer. This one didn't have Johnny Cash's Hurt, so it's not as good.
I mean, you couldn't do that again. No. Like, that would have felt cheap.
Could have used a different Johnny Cash song. Yeah. Folsom Prison Blues.
Sure, yeah.
No. But, anyway, this was still a really good trailer, and that movie looks better than it has any right to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, really excited for this movie. And one of the things I really liked about this trailer is it felt less like The Last of Us, you know? Like, if you got hints of, like... The world still exists and is okay out there, because it's like the trailer starts with X-23 in a convenience store and like buying stuff, and like a guy's like, hey, or like shoplifting stuff, and the guy's like, hey, you can't do that. And I was like, okay, yeah, like society still exists, and you didn't really necessarily see that in the first trailer. It looked a bit more just straight post-apocalyptic. And I like the idea of like the apocalypse only happened for mutants, and humans are totally fine and have been like operating fine the entire time.
It would, yeah, I'm really interested to see what they're doing with this, because these two trailers are actually very different. This one did not feel repetitive on the first one.
Yeah.
And it feels like they're pitching this very smartly, which is that this is not like any other X-Men or, frankly, superhero movie, but it's not just straight up ripping off another genre either. It feels like something very unique from these ads, and I'm excited for that, because I think X-Men Apocalypse showed we've maybe gone as far as we can with traditional X-Men movies.
Yeah. Maybe went a little bit further than we ever should have.
Maybe. And, but Deadpool was really good because it went way outside the box.
Yeah.
And this one looks like it's going further outside the box in a much more, I think, artistic way. And I'm excited for this fucking movie.
Every time we get to the trailer, we just got the second one. But it's like, I just keep on seeing Hugh Jackman, and I feel like it reminds me that every single time Hugh Jackman plays Wolverine, he's even better at it.
Yes.
It's kind of amazing. I saw a picture online the other day of like someone just posted the thing of it was like a picture of Hugh Jackman from his first appearance in X-Men and then him from like the trailer in Logan. And it's like, how much more he just looks like Wolverine now is insane to me. Of like, it's like when you look back at him from X-Men 1 and 2 and stuff like that, he kind of doesn't look like Wolverine anymore. Like, right. I associate the appearance of the character with how Hugh Jackman looks today. I think he's so right for the part now. I think he's like aged into it kind of perfectly.
And he's just, they've given him better material. And, like I talked about this with Days of Future Past, the reason that movie worked so well for me was its kind of focus on coming around on Wolverine's arc where that he kind of gets this finally happy ending after going through all this shit. And, that's the right kind of way to treat that movie, is because he has been the linchpin of that franchise. And anyway, this trailer was good. There's that little moment where they're reading the comic, and I like the idea of kind of tying that in and Logan being there to say, like, this is like the myth of the X-Men. We know what really... And maybe Logan will sit down with X-23 and say, I'm going to unwind the continuity for you.
Yeah.
All right, here's what actually
happened. That would be great. That's like the whole second act of the movie is Wolverine just trying to sort of explain. But even he can't do it.
No.
Like, somebody's it's like... But wait, was Scott like 30 or is he like 20? No, that can't be right, can it? Fuck.
When did Jean Grey become Phoenix? Because they're saying it happened in the 80s now.
Yeah. It's like, do I remember that I time traveled, or was that just something that someone told me? Fuck, I can't remember anymore. Yeah. I am too old for this shit.
I mean, the best thing, though, is that Logan looks like it's pretty disconnected from all that continuity, mm-hmm. so it'll just be a good standalone movie, and that's what we want. Kind of like what, frankly, the other Wolverine, the Wolverine in Japan one was, which has its problems, but it does work as its own three-act movie. Two acts plus a bad third act, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so.
No. Like, I keep on feeling like I really need to rewatch that movie again, because I haven't seen it since it came out in theaters.
Yeah, there's an awful lot I liked about it. So, yeah, I'm psyched for this movie. I mean, we got a lot of good-looking superhero movies coming out this year. This is the one I'm most intrigued with, just on the level of, like, this is not what I was expecting. Like, Spider-Man Homecoming, I'm probably more excited for, just because it's like... But that's also, it's Marvel makes a Spider-Man movie, it's a layup. It's like, yes, that's what I want. But Logan is, I didn't expect this from a Fox Wolverine movie, you know?
Yeah, and the most exciting part of it is that it's not that far away.
Yeah,
you know,
March.
It's pretty soon.
Same weekend as the Nintendo Switch.
There you go,
All right, so we got that. Star Wars, kind of out of the blue, they announced the title for the new Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Which is actually what they did with The Force Awakens a couple years ago, too. They did not make a big deal out of it. They just kind of dropped it, which I like when they're not too coy about the marketing with this stuff.
Yeah, it's like, you've got enough, like... super, like, crazy surprises you can be super coy about. You don't have to be super coy about the fucking subtitle of your movie.
Yeah. So it's called Star Wars The Last Jedi. Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. I like it. Good title.
Sure. Yeah. Like, the one thing is it kind of, for me, it kind of reminded me of, like, that could have been the subtitle for Return of the Jedi, and it's, like, how, like, little we've moved, like, in terms of, like, the large scale of the universe, which one of my issues with The Force Awakens is I wish it kind of, like, pushed the status quo in a different direction. But, like... You know, fucking, I'm super, it's Star Wars stuff, I'm excited for it, you know.
Plus, this is the one where we really get Mark Hamill.
Yeah, this is the one where we get to see Luke Skywalker again, so it's like, you know, you're putting that in the fucking title for me, thank you. Like, yes, we get to, and it was also fun to see a bunch of people then, like, take the subtitle and, like, go super crazy, like, plot theory about it, and a bunch of people having arguments about, like, but, you know, you see, the thing is that the plural of Jedi is just Jedi, so this could be, it's not just talking about Luke, it's like, you know nothing about this movie other than, like, its cast, some of its cast, its director, and this fucking subtitle. Stop trying to, like, figure out what the plot is from that, guys. Like, it's, like, you are right. The plural of Jedi is Jedi. That's meaningless. Like, who gives a shit?
I mean, I like it because it's just an evocative kind of Western title.
It's a good title for a movie. It's easy to say. It, like, TLJ is a good abbreviation. It reads well on text. Like, there you go.
And, you know, I would be excited for this one even if I didn't like The Force Awakens, just because it's fucking Rian Johnson doing a Star Wars movie is so exciting to me. And I, you know, all the reports are that if you didn't like that Force Awakens and Rogue One were a little, you know, kind of orthodox Star Wars, Rian Johnson is apparently not going in that direction with this.
That'd be good.
He's going to kind of blow the doors off it. And I'm excited, and we have a title now, so we know what to call it, and that's nice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we could call it Episode 8, but it's nice to have an actual title. Because at a certain point, there's going to be too many episodes to easily remember them by their numbers.
I am kind of getting to that point where I keep on forgetting, like, where, like, that we're, like, right, okay, the next one is Episode 8. 8. Right. I need to, like, I've just been so used to there being 6 episodes of Star Wars. There's been 6 episodes of Star Wars, even when there were only 3 episodes of Star Wars, because the last one was the 6th one.
It's too confusing.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
even now. And still, like, the technical title of the 4th one is still, to most a lot of people, just Star Wars.
Right,
so it's a weird thing. Anyway, so let's go ahead and move on. We also had another trailer for Mass Effect Andromeda. This one was interesting because it gave us more story indications than we'd had before.
Yeah, this is the first trailer for Mass Effect Andromeda I liked.
Okay. I thought it was fine. I don't know. I don't know where I am with this game. I can't track it
anymore. Yeah, like... I am in a weird place where I feel like we're getting close enough to this, like, what they say the release date is going to be, that I feel like maybe that is actually going to be the release date, and their marketing for this game has just been unbelievably bad.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm kind of falling more on that side at this point.
Yeah, I mean, they would have to delay it pretty soon if they're delaying it, but it just frankly worries me if that's actually the release date, because this, again, this looked like the cinematic trailer you show a year and a half out from launch, not a month and a half out. It's, you know, it's got a little bit of indication of what you got the species you're familiar with, and they're out in the Andromeda Galaxy, and there's this villain, and we get some of that. I liked it fine. I'm also still, I want to play the game. I'm excited. To me, it's also Mass Effect is a thing that ended, and I don't need them to make Mass Effect games until the end of time. And I still have not seen the compelling thing that makes me see why do I need the new Mass Effect game, other than it's just called Mass Effect. And this one, like, you know, I'm curious with the story, but like, what is the justification for all the same species being there and things like that? I'm curious about all of that.
Well, I think it's just that like they sent a bunch of different colony ships, so like there's just a bunch of like, you know, there's a bunch of like Krogans on one of them or something. That's how you'd run into them.
Yeah,
I did think that I liked the one scene in the trailer that it had a very like Star Trek-y feel of a bunch of people on like the bridge of the ship or whatever, looking at a screen of like, oh, here's this alien species we've never seen before. But I kind of wish that the alien species didn't look so much like a Star Trek alien and that it looked like a person wearing a suit, which is like how Mass Effect it generally is, with like a couple of exceptions like the Hanar, like the jellyfish people and stuff like that. But for the most part, they're normal like humanoid looking things. But like, if we're going to another galaxy, I would want, and maybe hopefully they have like some more crazy alien designs that they'll show, but I want something that even if there is no scientific reason for them to be like reasonably more insane looking than just other aliens in our own galaxy, like in an emotional and like narrative thing, I want like aliens from another galaxy to just be like, what the fuck are we even looking at, kind of like 2001 A Space Odyssey level stuff, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely see. This is, I feel I'm in a weird place where I'm kind of tepid about a new Mass Effect, and it's for a lot of reasons. I hope it's great, you know, and I would, if I had to bet money, it would be more likely to be good than not.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to be a bad game, but it is like, it's hard to tell if it's going to be a very good game or not.
Like, again, you're right. I mean, we're at the point where it is entirely possible they're actually going to make this crazy release date, and is that the game really is finished and it's fine, or is that the game isn't finished, or is it that, as you say, just no one remembered to market it?
Like, yeah, I'm just hoping that like some like new guy got hired up to a high level marketing position. It was like, I've got this whole strategy. It's like, we don't show anything about this game, but like bullshit behind the scenes things. And then like the half a year before it comes out, we show a shitty tiny little teaser for the unveiling of the PS4 Pro, and it'll be the best marketing ever. And was like, oh fuck it, we don't give a shit, we'll just go with that. Like, I'm hoping that's what it was, because that's, like, the best-case scenario for how this game comes out, is that it was just a terrible marketing strategy.
Yeah, it's very, because, you know, and again, we've made this comparison before. The easy comparison is something like Zelda Breath of the Wild, which also technically has not shown a lot. But the difference is that when you watch those Breath of the Wild teases, they are big and confident and kind of thematically and aesthetically on point and of a piece with one another. And they've also shown enough gameplay where you can very confidently say, that looks like a finished game that you can play, and I know generally what that game is, even if I've seen very little of it. They're evocative teases. They're not, you know, unfinished marketing.
Yeah.
And with Mass Effect, we're getting a lot of just what feels like unfinished teases.
Yeah, and like Zelda has had two opportunities now with E3 and the Switch presentation where like a lot of game journalists got hands-on time playing it and like writing previews. And as far as I know, other than, actually, I think even at the PS4 Pro thing, like there were demos that were definitely being showed to games press people. I don't think they were hands-on. As far as I know, there has not been like a single hands-on preview kind of thing of like game journalists getting like their hands on a preview build of that and being able to be like, okay, we played Mass Effect Andromeda for 30 minutes at E3. Here's our write-up of it. I haven't seen a single one of those. It's like, game is supposed to almost be out.
It's bizarre because Mass Effect is a big franchise and it's popular, but the only game franchise that's frankly big enough for you to get away with that kind of thing with is like Mario or Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, where you really don't show any of it. Like, Mass Effect is not that level where it's just automatically going to sell to everyone.
Yeah.
It'll sell to a lot of people, like you and me and people who loved those games, but, you know, it's been a while since the last one.
Some bad people really hated Mass Effect 3.
Yeah, so it's very weird. Very few people know anything about this game. So we'll see. Maybe it actually comes out March 21st and we all eat our words. But
yeah, like, it's getting close enough that I feel like I probably should just fucking pre-order this thing on Amazon at some point. I mean, there's no reason for me not to.
Yeah.
But like, I just have been so unconvinced by the marketing that even though there's no world in which I don't play the new Mass Effect game, I still haven't pre-ordered it yet.
Yeah, it's very strange. I'm in the same scenario, but oh well. One other interesting thing is that this is going to be a long ways off, but we did get a cool tease about it, which is that Square Enix, with their studios Crystal Dynamics and Eidos Montreal, are developing a series of, actually, Avengers games.
Yeah.
in conjunction with Marvel. This looks like it's part of Marvel's sort of bigger program to start making some video games. We also know that Sony, with Insomniac, is that the right studio?
Yeah.
Is making that Spider-Man game for the PS4, which looks awesome. This will be a full-on Avengers game for probably multiple platforms, made by Crystal Dynamics and Eidos Montreal, who have proven themselves on such as like the Tomb Raider series.
Yeah, Rise of Tomb Raider.
Which is awesome, although this kind of confirms those reports that they're not working on the third Tomb Raider, which is sad.
Yeah. I still haven't gotten around to playing Rise of the Tomb Raider on the PS4 yet.
You're going to love it. So good.
Yeah, I'm so excited to get it. But
anyway.
There has been a non-stop release of games, and it's fucking January, and it's like, I thought that the game thing was going to, like, slow down after 2016, and it fucking hasn't.
No.
Like, there are four games coming out, like, this month and then the next month that I want to get. It's like, what the fuck is happening?
No, there's, like, four games out right now I want to play. Like, because neither of us have played Resident Evil 7, right?
No, and, like, as someone who really likes the Resident Evil remake and really likes Resident Evil 4, everything I've seen about Resident Evil 7 tells me that that is the Resident Evil game I've wanted to play since I played 4.
Yes.
It's like, I'm never going to fucking find time to play Resident Evil 7 because I just finished Gravity Rush 2. Yakuza 0 is on the way. I've already pre-ordered that. I want to play Neo, and I have Horizon Zero Dawn pre-ordered, which comes at the end of February. Neo is at the beginning of February, and like Resident Evil 7 just came out. In what time frame am I fucking putting playing all those
maybe
games?
Maybe summer.
Yeah,
I don't
with
know.
All the like the money I'd have to put down for all of them too.
Yeah, I'm going to try to play Resident Evil 7 by the end of the year, maybe when it gets on a sale.
Yeah,
some
I'm
point.
Hoping like maybe the around Halloween I can like blow that through in a whole night or something because people say it's like 10 hours.
Yeah, so. Except, but there's so much, and it's just fucking January. It's insane. This does look like it's going to be another year where maybe we get a slowdown over the summer, which will be nice if we get that. But it's a sprint. I mean, like, I'm probably not going to pre-order Horizon Zero Dawn because that comes out, like, 3 days before the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
So you can cover that, and I'll cover Zelda, and we can tag team that one or something.
If you know, who knows? Maybe there will be Master Swords in Horizon Zero Dawn and robot dinosaurs in Zelda. As far as we know, that's totally possible.
It's just, there are robot enemies in Zelda, sort of. There's like Miyazaki robots in it. So anyway, lots of games coming out. Anyway, getting a new Avengers game from Square Enix, from Crystal Dynamics, that sounds awesome, right?
Yeah. And it's just something I'm, more than anything else, I'm just excited at the idea of Marvel finally like actually making video games, and then like, it sounds like they're doing it the right way of like creating an internal studio that is going to work with like well-established video game developers and publishers to let them do what they do. Like everything we saw out of the last E3 with that Spider-Man game and the interviews around that, even if obviously that game is like very early on in development, relatively speaking, or was specifically when it was showed, like all the game they were talking about it on the business side of things sounded like they were doing it the right way, and hopefully people have finally, after like 10 years, have started learning the lesson from Batman Arkham Asylum, which came out like 2008 or whatever. It's like, we're finally there of like, you have properties that millions, tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people around the whole world love. These characters that people adore and like go to the movie theater like multiple times a year to go see these characters, and somehow you have not taken advantage of that on video games, and it's like finally they're getting around to doing that.
Maybe one day they'll do it with comics too.
No, that's over. Comic books are done.
So bizarre. We never talk about that on the show, how bizarre it is that like it is harder to buy comics than ever before. And
like
less...
even I haven't bought a new comic book in years now.
And yet comic book properties are bigger than ever.
Yeah.
Marvel and DC do not know what the fuck they're doing on that side of things. It's hilarious.
I don't know how you sell comic books anymore. Like, nobody wants to go to a comic book shop, and I don't think that...
Sell them at comic book shops!
Yeah, but, like, I mean, that's the thing is, like, you can't not do... Like, you can't go back to, like... Because newspaper stands don't exist, and you have to find some way to try to market digital comics to people, but, like, even that on the best digital comic apps, like, it's still not a great experience I've found reading comics digitally. Because it's like, I feel like if you want to read comics digitally, we're going to have to abandon physical comics and, like, take advantage of what you could do with a completely digital comic and not worry about, like, how you scan a page digitally.
Right.
It's like, comic books are in a weird fucking spot.
Manga works because it's black and white. It's great.
And it's cheap.
Yeah.
And, like, and there are venues of, like, there are magazine stands at in Japan that, like, you can go buy your Shonen Jump. You know, like, that market just doesn't exist in America anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. Anyway, so hopefully we are going to be entering a glorious renaissance for superhero games with this. It could be so cool.
Yeah.
And... especially because now we're not going to get any more Rocksteady Batman games. So we need someone to fill that void.
Yeah.
Which really means we need Shadow of Mordor Middle-Earth 2.
Exactly. You know, I mean, just because Rocksteady stops making Batman games doesn't mean we can't just take other properties and just throw the Batman combat onto it till the end of time.
Okay, what like current movie franchise would be least suited to that, but you would least like to see suited. For comedy purposes?
Fuck, I don't know. Like, I've immediately thought of like the Fantastic Beasts, Harry Potter stuff. Just yeah,
you do that, it somehow. Newt has his wand, and that's the thing. That's,
I mean,
like,
they made those last couple of Harry Potter games for the last movies were basically Gears of War clones. So it's like you can do whatever you want. Like, well, they made cover shooters out of Harry Potter.
They jumped around in genres. Like, I think Order of the Phoenix was like a bully style Rocksteady or Rockstar kind of game, and then I forget what Half Blood Prince was. The first Deathly Hallows was like a Kinect kind of thing, and you did that. And then I did play Deathly Hallows Part 2, and that was a full on Gears of War cover based. Shooter with your wand where your weapons were different spells.
Yeah, like, I was just hoping to see the footage of, like, Harry, like, slamming into cover and going, like, ah, shit, and, like, slapping on his wand because he fucked up the active reload.
Hermione!
Ron!
It'd be funny. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, get John DiMaggio to voice Harry in the next Harry Potter game. The video game adaptation of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, the play. J.K. Rowling has said they're not making a movie. No, they're going to make a fucking intense FPS game.
Hardcore, M-rated FPS game. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be great. By the makers of Doom.
Yes.
No. All right, we're getting off track.
This podcast is off track.
And that was all the news. Let's talk about Gravity Rush 2.
Okay.
We got carried away talking about it at the top of the show.
I just finished the game. I'm so excited about it. It's hard not to just talk about it. And it's frustrating because you haven't fucking finished it.
I'm sorry.
So I can't talk about, like, the insane shit that happens in that game.
So can I just talk about where I am in the game?
Yeah, because obviously we have to talk about where you are.
Yeah. So I just finished episode 10. To my understanding, there's like 21 main episodes, something like that.
Yeah, like about that, because there's more than that, but some of them are pretty short, like kind of story chapters that don't have a lot of gameplay.
Yeah. So, and I actually really, I want to start by just saying I really like the structure of this game.
Yeah, me too.
Because one of the things I realized playing Gravity Rush 1, which is, Gravity Rush 1 is sort of like a miniature open world game, where you have an open world, but it's not big, but it's also not the kind of like hub world thing you get in a Mario 64, or even kind of like a Batman Arkham City or something like
that. Yeah, like there's a couple of small, like kind of almost dungeons, which Gravity Rush 2 has some of those as well, but like it was in such a weird spot where the open world was not big enough to really think of it as an open world game, but there weren't enough sort of like dungeony kind of areas that you ended up going in the story for it to feel like a hub world either.
Yeah. But the way I wound up playing Gravity Rush 1 is I really play these games kind of in a very relaxed way because I find them both exhilarating and relaxing. And they're exhilarating because there is no other game like Gravity Rush. It is as unique a game as I've ever played.
Yeah.
But it is also, it compels you to play it at a relaxed pace and just kind of breathe in the world. And I love doing that in Gravity Rush 1. And what that really meant spent a lot of time doing was collecting those fucking gems, because it is, it's not even that the gems themselves are cool collectibles. It's just exploring that world and where they place the gems and the process of, you'll be heading to your next objective and then you'll see some gems and 30 minutes later you'll remember you had an objective.
Yeah.
And you just explore all these nooks and crannies of the upside down world of these buildings that you're like, no other developer would even think to build out this stuff. And they're like the coolest parts of the game graphically. And so Gravity Rush I played very relaxed. And I feel like Gravity Rush 2 actually leverages that pace extremely intelligently to the point where I would compel anybody making an open world game to look at Gravity Rush 2, because I think they have cracked this in a similar way to how I felt when I played The Witcher 3, of like, this game fucking gets it.
Yeah.
And that's that, so you play like, so there's the main episodes, which are like the main numbered chapter missions. And those tend to be pretty big, like half an hour long missions that you play. There's a lot of meat to them, and that's where the main story unfolds.
Yeah.
But then every time you beat one of those, you're back in the open world, and you have a series of side missions and challenges that unlock. But they don't give them, too many of them to you at a time.
No, it's basically after each main mission, you unlock between like 3 to 4 side missions and probably 1 or 2 challenge missions.
Yeah. And so what I always do is I go around, I finish all the side missions, all the challenges before I even look at the next episode. Yeah. And the other thing is that the story is built in such a way where, at least early on, and at some point it gets more intense, but for the most part, every episode ends in a way where it feels natural for Kat to be out doing her thing in the world. And it's not like, you know, something like Final Fantasy 15, where you're like, Noctis, why are you fishing? Your dad is dead.
Yeah, your dad is dead. Your entire kingdom has crumbled. It's like you're a king without a kingdom, and you're going and you're fishing with your friends.
But the other thing is that those side missions have way more narrative meat to them than you would ever see in most open world side missions, where there is, every one of them has cutscenes, it has story, it has dialogue. There is a, like, they're all like little short stories. Like, this is a book of short stories that has like little novella portions put through. It's very much that kind of structure. adventure, and so they're really rewarding to play. The side missions are very varied. Some work better than others, but that's kind of the magic of Gravity Rush, is that it's great even when it's wonky. You know what I mean? Because there is some natural wonkiness to the game, and we'll talk about that later, but even that wonkiness can be kind of wonderful. So I really love the structure because it really encourages you to slow down, see everything, play it completionist. The reason I'm only at chapter 10 is, and I've played probably way more than 10 hours of this thing, but I'm doing everything I can as it opens up to me, and that's the way to play it. And I do feel like even the main story kind of leverages that, where, for instance, two of the new characters in this are Lisa, who is this woman who kind of runs this settlement, and she takes you in, and she has this adopted daughter named Cece. And a lot of the development between Lisa and Cece, which is key to the story, actually happens in some of those side missions.
Yeah.
But it kind of like in The Witcher 3, some of the stuff that gets you closest to Geralt happens in this what are technically side quests, but nothing feels like it is too far off the beaten track narratively.
Or like in The Witcher 3, it was a pretty common thing of like you would encounter a character like Kira Metz or someone like that in a main story quest, but then that would like branch off into this whole like different side quest that like developed that character and Geralt's relationship with them that didn't wrap back into the main quest in any way, but it was like it was this branching off point. Yeah, Gravity Rush 2 definitely has that similar structure, not just with like characters like you said with Lisa and Cece, and does it with like a lot of the side characters in the game. And some of them are like side characters that exist almost entirely in side missions that have like their own chains. But it's also like the world building is done a lot in the side missions of you exploring like the culture and the sort of the pitfalls of the culture in Jurgapar Lao,
yes.
Which has this like very intense class structure that is like quite literally like you have an underclass that lives below everyone. You have like the middle class that is the marketplace in the middle. You have your upper class, which lives in floating islands on mansions at the top. And then all the way above that, there's a floating battleship. And sort of in Jurgapar Lao, the side quest, even like the most sort of like silly mundane side quests, tend to at least in some way comment on how these different classes interact and like how Kat needs to find a way to sort of bridge that and like not fix the society, but like it has to find some way for her like, you know, intense optimism and compassion to sort of like wrestle with this world that she is not native to, that she has just been dropped into and tries to understand and tries to do her best to like help people.
Because, you know, the first game happens in this city called Hexaville, which is sort of utopian in a weird way. Like, it's not a city that was perfect or anything, but it mostly was free of, like, major strife.
Yeah. It didn't have, like, you know, it didn't struggle with, like, racism or economic disparity. Like, it had issues with, like, the mayor was an asshole and stuff like that. But it didn't have... Like, Gravity Rush 1 was much more about, like, broader, like, kind of weird philosophical issues in the story than it was about, like, specific, like, down-to-earth social issues.
And just introducing the characters.
Yeah.
You know, the characters are very... And that's one thing to know is that, you know, there is no real narrative reason you can't play Gravity Rush 2 without playing 1.
That is not true.
Okay, well, at least one of
them. That is so unbelievably not true. You have no idea.
Okay.
You'll get there.
Anyway, but what I was going to say is it's the character foundation that is so key. And I do wonder, just reading some reviews, how many critics have not played Gravity Rush 1. Because a lot of the issues I see certain critics raise with it, I'm like... Maybe it's because I've played 1, maybe it's because this is just more my thing. Boy, is that not the case, having come from that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've seen a lot of people saying, criticizing the story in this game is incomprehensible. It's so not that to me at all.
It gets weirder at the end. Like, it kind of, it makes, in a lot of different ways, without trying to spoil stuff, it makes a stylistic return to how some of the storytelling stuff was in Gravity Rush 1. And so I can see how some people would find that, like, quote-unquote, incomprehensible. I think it worked. I think, actually, they did it better. It, like, a lot of that stuff better than Gravity Rush 1. And it is something that, like, I really wish that the series had retained its Japanese title of Gravity Days, like, DAZE, because part of that, like, I feel like that is a part of the effect of the game. It has a sort of daze to it. It has a dream-like quality to it, even in, like, the beginning sections. Really, the first half of Gravity Rush 2, of, like, where it is more grounded than Gravity Rush 1 was a lot of times, like, it still has a dreamlike quality to it, which comes from a lot of its influences in French comic books. And so it's like, I think, like, it is not incomprehensible, it is just, like, some of the plot stuff that happens is not strictly logical, it has more of, like, a dreamlike quality to it. In the way that, like, if you remember, like, in Gravity Rush 1, you had, like, the god characters and, like, going into, like, weird delusions, like, falling, like, all the way down there, and, like, the weird time dilation stuff that happened. Like, it deals with some of those kinds of stuff later in Gravity Rush 2.
Okay.
But I think it does it very well.
Yeah, I mean, so far I was just going to say I'm very taken by the story. And getting back to the overall structural stuff, we'll talk about more of some of the presentation. I do feel the same way I felt, like, in my memory of, like, The Witcher 3, where I cannot immediately, even just in these first 10 episodes I've played, it's hard for me to say what was in the main episodes and what was in side quests.
Yeah.
Because it all feels of a piece where it's like, the experience is everything. There's no, like, junk stuff to do in this game. Even side quests I find mechanically more obnoxious than other ones. Like, I find them valuable as part of the overall tapestry, and that's kind of all you can ask for from this kind of game, and I love that about it. That no matter what I'm doing, it does feel like part of the tapestry. And we're talking about story stuff right now. I also do think mechanically one of the things that's interesting is how those side quests, you know, flesh out certain mechanics. Like, I just got to the part, I think it's episode 9, is where you get your second, like, set of gravity powers, which is
your lunar powers.
Yeah, your lunar powers. And in that episode, I hated them immediately because the tutorial part of that, I thought I was just intensely obnoxious to me. Like, I couldn't, like, the controls just didn't feel like they were working. It felt, like, off. But then I got back into the main world, and I got to use them there. And I used them in a couple side quests because it, like, opens up a challenge and a side quest where you use them. And then it kind of clicked into place in a way where it's like, that's the beauty of this game, is that it all works as a whole. And actually that part where it's like, it has to, like, take it out and just show it to you on its own so it can introduce it to you, kind of by its very nature has to be weaker, because the point here is the overall, not these little, like, sliced off portions, which is what a lot of games would do.
Sure.
So
yeah, I just want to say, for, like, I thought the part where you get introduced to the lunar powers, like, that was one of my favorite parts of the game. Like, okay. That whole candle lit section, that stuff.
I like it visually. I just, gameplay wise, it rubbed me the wrong way.
Like, you're, like, jumping off of the bubbles and shit. Fucking cool.
I could not, for the life of me, in that part, I could not get some of that to work.
I guess I just, like, took to the lunar powers very quickly. That's, like, okay. Kind of like one of my favorite parts of that game is jumping around with them.
Again, I took to them when I got to be in the city and just kind of do what I was kind of used to doing. But one thing that, well, we'll get into it later. But okay. Yeah. So all of that. I was just gonna say, presentation wise, and or not presentation wise, structural wise. I really love this game, and I love that, you know, it's a game I want to play kind of relaxed and at my own pace. And part of why I decided I need to prioritize Persona 4 right now and just finish it is just because I felt like I was doing a real disservice to Gravity Rush 2 by trying to balance it with this really, like, intense JRPG.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, like, and I feel basically the exact same way you do about the structure of that, like, and I played it the same way you did, obviously, because we're both completionists to different degrees when we play video games, of like, I played a story mission and then I went and I did all the side missions and I did all, then I got golds on all the challenge missions and then I did the next story mission, and like, the game is very deliberately, I think, structured that way. And I do want to say, as someone who's finished the game, I think people should play it that way, because there would be points in the story, I assume, obviously, because I finished the stuff I was playing it, but it seemed like there are parts where when you got to the story that until you beat the game, there would be some side missions that if you had not done them, you would not be able to go back to them because things change. And so, like, that's... So, like, if people are, like, worried about that, like, that is something that would happen to the game, and it does not always signpost that stuff. So, like, I would be playing those while you're going along regardless because of that issue. But it is, like, the game is built very specifically to have that very textured experience of... You have, like, the more, especially when you get deeper in, the much more intense, like, big, of course, combat heavy and lore heavy story sections where, like, the plot moves forward, and usually something like pretty significant shifts in that section in terms of, like, where characters are and, like, Kat's position in the world and stuff like that. And sometimes the environment itself will have, like, be deformed by some action that happened in the story, like, even in, like, a very small way. Like, I assume you got the stuff where, like, you, like, get Raven on your side again, right?
Oh, yeah.
That happens before that? Because I can't remember how the order of all the things happened. But, you know, in that cutscene, when you get Raven back, you knock her into, like, that thing that's on, like, a water tower or whatever, or on top of the airboats, and, like, that deforms in the cutscene. Like, that deforms in the game. And there are some more, like, extreme examples of that happening, of things moving or getting destroyed in story stuff. That retains in the game. And, like, that sort of pace I find really interesting, of, like, this mix between open world with your side missions and all that, and more linear stuff of where, like, the game is willing to sort of block things off or change things and, like, move forward in significant ways when you do a main story chapter. And then the side missions you play will typically be either very directly or oftentimes in, like, a very abstract way, will be almost inevitably connected to something that just happened in the previous story section. And it's some stuff, like, some of the side missions. Have you done the side mission where you, like, you have to go get an author who has, like, run away from his deadline?
Yes.
And bring him back? That, I think, is maybe the highlight story mission for me. And its sequel is also really good. of that it is really funny, and Gravity Rush 2 is a brilliantly funny game in places. And the whole setup is Cat it goes and finds this one person that like gives you the side quest. Is like, oh, I'm the publisher for this like author, and he's run away, and his book is about this guy who like has like lives gets a wish granted to live three lives, and he just lives a life as like a poor person, like basically someone who's poor, someone who's middle class, and someone who's rich is basically the structure of it. Obviously, they don't just throw it out like that, but that's what it is. And so this author has gone and is like pretending to be all these different characters in that book of those different stages to sort of like try to figure out how to finish his novel, and you need to go get him and bring him back because he's going to miss his deadline. And so that's your quest. It is like, it's brilliant because it's like it plays off of my favorite part of Kat's character, that she will just do anything if someone asks it nicely enough of her, because she's just that nice and she's very naive. And she'll just go do it, and she'll be like, and she's so very gung ho about it all the time. That her character is so brilliant.
I love Kat. Kat is such a great character.
Yeah, like they just.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah,
later.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. And so it gets that. It's a really funny setup. But then also, as you are going through that mission, it is something like if I was teaching a class. Like I was teaching like a school class about class privilege, like economic class privilege, I'd fucking play that mission for them, because that whole mission is about this rich dude, this privileged rich dude who he's an author that's like extremely rich and is basically shirking his work and going, and he's posing as a like a gang member who's living in the slums, and he's just hiding down there, and you go down there to find him. And at this point, the Cat has basically befriended these like quote unquote gang members in the slums, because they're really like people that are trying to help their community. And so she's friends with them, and she goes down there, and he kind of like tries to throw her to the wolves and go like, oh, it's like the police, and points at her, and he runs away. And all the gang members are like, what is he talking about? It's just Cat. And it's something where he gets to pose as one of these gang members without ever, and like being posed as someone in the slums without having to deal with any of the actual issues there, and not being tied into any of like the social circles and not knowing anything real about it, just dressing up as it. And then he moves up to the middle class. In the middle class, he dresses up as a dock worker, but because he doesn't want to or can't do the actual physical labor that the dock workers have to do to survive, he's just standing there counting the boxes and not doing any of the actual work. So it's, again, it's this guy who doesn't need to do this, and to try to like understand the middle class, he's just standing there dressed like them, counting boxes and not getting any of the actual, like, he's not moving these boxes, and he doesn't understand that all these guys are doing this, like, they move like 100 boxes a day on their own, like, physical labor to try to make ends meet, and he doesn't get that. And there's something about that, like, and it's funny every time you do it, because you're trying to chase him down, and like, and it's, as with every single side quest in that game, it's built on a completely unique mechanic of this one. You have to, like, take the hints you are given and, like, a picture of, like, the basic character model and, like, scout out the environment and figure out who he is. No other side quest, no main quest in that game other than even the direct sequel to that side quest doesn't even really use that mechanic.
It's very, I just played that today, so yeah.
Yeah, like it never uses those mechanics again, and almost every single side quest is like that. It's like, it will take the mechanics of the things built in the game and use them in a completely kind of throwaway way and say like, okay, we'll use that as the objective for this and never do it again. So it has that gameplay variety, but then it also just, in a very subtle and kind of smart, funny way, comments on the way the class system in this world works of like, this guy can just do this. Like, he can just get in his gravity car and go down there and pretend to be these people. But like, the dock worker cannot go up to the mansions and the floating sky islands, and the people living in the slums most of the times can't even all get up to the docks, because the classes are not just separated by wealth, they are separated by physical space and by gravity. And it's like that sort of visual metaphor of like the floating islands and the way it is very literally vertically stratified, coupled with the really smart storytelling that explores different avenues of that, makes Gravity Rush 2 like, honestly, one of the smartest games about class struggle and class conflict that I have ever seen. And that's such a patently absurd statement that I still can't believe it.
But it's true. Like, and it dawns
it's so
on you.
True.
It dawns on you slowly that that's what the game is doing. Because one thing to note about Gravity Rush 2 is that it has a pretty slow opening. Like, the opening section of the game is very slow. I'm not saying slow bad. People often use that pejoratively. I don't think it's bad.
It's deliberate.
It's deliberate and it's slow. And it's very much in contrast to Gravity Rush 1, where literally the apple falls down the hill and you wake up and you have your powers and you go do stuff.
Yeah, Gravity Rush 2, I think, is a smart choice they make. And they sort of do some other stuff later in the game that it's a similar kind of stuff of that they want to make it so that, like, when you get your gravity powers, you feel it. Because at the beginning of the game, you are so slow, and you're so restricted, and it's like you have to walk upstairs and walk across bridges, and then you get your gravity powers, and she is completely free and can go wherever she wants.
But it really is like a good novel in that, at the beginning, you might chafe against it a little bit just because it's moving slowly, but then once you get into the meat of it, you're like, man, if it hadn't done that at the beginning, I wouldn't be feeling this the way I am. Yeah. And where that was for me is, it's moving a little slowly, you finally get to Jirga Parga Lao, the main... Am I saying that right?
Jirga Power Lao. Is,
Jirga Par... Yeah. It's hard to say, but anyway.
Jirga Power Lao!
Yeah, something like that.
If you want to say it.
But yeah. Jirga Par... You get to the big, you know, open world city, Jirga Parga Lao, and you start doing things, and the game is very... You know, it's an open world that is very linear, and I think that's... I love that about it, that it really does, because of that structure where you play a chapter, it unlocks a select number of side quests, not just it has a bunch of junk objectives on the map.
Yeah.
And you go through and you play those in kind of whatever order you want, but you do play those. It introduces you to things as it wants you to be introduced to them. And so you play it, and at first you think, okay, this is kind of interesting. It's like a bigger version of Hexaville, you know. And it's really not. You find out eventually this is not anything like Hexaville in a lot of ways. But you think it is for a little bit. And then I think where the game got me was when you go down and you don't even know it's there. You would never even think to go down there, because in Hexaville, in Gravity Rush 1, you would just die if you went down that far.
Yeah.
Is you go down to the slums, basically, and you fall down below beneath the other layer of clouds, and you find out there's this whole other city there, and the music there is this beautiful, just mournful little kind of dirge thing. And there's these people living their lives, and Kat goes down there kind of on one of her righteous missions, because she thinks someone is doing something bad.
Yeah, they think like someone has stolen... Actually, I think someone has like stolen their cargo, and she's just going to go get it back.
Yeah, which is a story you did a bunch in Gravity Rush 1, so you're specifically leveraging your experience, and you get down there and you learn that the situation is way more complex and that these people need you to be their hero way more than the people up top.
Yeah.
And that's the decision Kat makes, and it's just that hooked me by the heart and by the mind, because it's so smart. I mean, this is a game that literally chose its story for its second game based on the basic idea that you have the mechanics of a character who uses gravity and goes up and down and all over. And so one of the things I was thinking early on is like, man, this fucking crazy city, if you didn't have Kat's gravity powers, you couldn't go around anywhere. This is nuts. And then once I got down there, I'm like, yeah,
exactly.
That's nuts. Yeah. That's narrativized. Like, they know that. That's not just a silly video game thing. They're aware of that, and they decided that why Kat would be important in this world is she's literally the only one, other than Raven eventually, who can see what's going on here, because she actually can go from bottom to top, literally, but we're going to use this for this very smart allegory.
Yeah.
You know, we touched on allegory a little bit earlier with Westworld.
Yeah.
This, to me, is allegory done so well, because, for one, it's not like trivializing those issues. These are still people. They're not robots or something. But it's in this fantasy world where you're allowed to kind of visualize it in a way that is really direct and powerful. But it's also like the game is never on the nose about it. It's not like Kat says, we're going to go occupy Wall Street or something.
Right,
I don't know. Like, she doesn't like do something crazy like that where they all like get their picket signs and do something like that. It's much more about experientially you living this alongside Kat and letting the story go by. And, you know, again, because it really is deliberate and careful in how it lays out the pieces. Like, even, you know, you see the different military elements, but it's pretty deep into the game before you realize, oh, shit, there's a whole garrison on top of this city.
Yeah, like, this whole city is basically being ruled by the military-industrial complex. And you're right, like, at first you don't even notice it. Like, you don't see that there are, like, armed guards that are in the crowds and stuff like that. You're just, like, walking around. And it isn't until you have that moment that, to me, like, it was just completely breathtaking of you're in that quest, and you get a quest marker that's like, oh, like, they said, it's like, oh, he's kind of, like, down there, like, in, like, blah, 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 like, whatever the name of that part of the slums are, like, Lay or Gona or whatever, and she's like, okay, I guess I'll go there and get the quest marker, and it's just, like, an arrow that's pointing down, and it says, like, fucking, like, 300 meters or something, like, where is this? And you look, it's like, there's nothing there, it's like, I guess I'll go and, like you said, you jump down and, like, you go and you go so far, and, like, you have to go through a whole layer of clouds to even be able to see that there's, like, people living down here in these slums of, like, all these, like, little tiny crumbling rock islands with, like, way more buildings stuffed onto them than, like, is reasonable, which is such an incredible contrast to then when you go up to the mansion area and it's, like, people are, like, they're literally living in massive mansions that have their whole own sky island to themselves. And it's, like, it is the most opulent thing you could even, like, ever imagine. It's one of the ways that, like, they're very fantastical, dreamlike, visual thing of just like floating geography really works spectacularly is not just like the verticality of it, but like of that way of like how people in the lower middle class are all like crammed together. People in the upper class are like, I have my floating sky island with my beautiful mansion, and then we can go to the other giant floating sky island that's this beautiful garden with three different fountains and all this stuff, and like this big amphitheater, and it is this incredible contrast. And Kat being this sort of perfect outsider who has this ability to navigate those classes is such a smart storytelling tool. It's a thing that, like, one of the things that makes Kat's character so perfect is that you can tell kind of whatever story you need to with her, and she enables very specific kinds of stories by having her powers and by being someone who so wants to see the good in people and wants to fight for that good and is willing to sort of accept things, like, accept the orders of bad people, like, thinking that they're good and then having to sort of, like, realize her mistake and, like, turn back on it, which she does over the course of, like, both the games.
Or, and in some cases, not even bad people, but, like, on side quests where she'll go to just, like, yeah, I'll deliver these invitations. That's one of the first ones up in the rich sky place. It's like, I'll go deliver some invitations because Kat will do that. And then she realizes, one, the person who gave me the invitations is a dick. And then all the people I have to deliver them to are dicks and think I'm just a servant and make me do other things. And so that's one of those quests that you at first you're like, this is kind of an annoying fetch quest. And then you're like, yeah, this is kind of an annoying fetch quest. And Kat is thinking the same thing. Yeah. And there's a very deliberate reason they're making you do that. The joke, but also the commentary, the satire, only works if you actually have to do these things as Kat and go through all these hoops, because that's what that's the lives, these detached lives that these people lead.
Yeah.
And so it is this broad satire, but has this kernel of truth that both you and Kat kind of come to realize, and just those little moments where Kat will frown in the comic book panels and realize, like, you know, like she's never going to give up and stop doing these things because she said she was going to do it and she'll do it, but it's like she's disappointed that other people don't have the same kind of just innate faith she does.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I mean, she is just such a great character. You know, I was thinking earlier, because I got deeper into the part where Raven comes back. And you, I won't spoil any of those details, but Raven, one of the main characters in Gravity Rush 1, prominent character here.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Raven, one of the underlying things with their friendship is that Raven is really better at these things. She's had her powers for longer.
That's such a good side quest. The one where you're both mining.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so funny. And I was thinking, like, I don't think in the traditional, like, American or Japanese, like, superhero comic book version of this, I don't think Kat would be the main character. I think Raven would be. It's kind of like Raven is the Flash and Kat is Kid Flash or something like that. It's this weird kind of sidekick relationship, but where all the weight is placed on the person who I think traditionally would kind of be the sidekick because they're more naive and inexperienced.
Yeah, like she has a Robin or like almost like Jimmy Olsen-esque quality to her.
She really does. And, you know, but Raven is the person who has more of like the superhero outfit and who, you know, stands tall and who is supremely confident about everything.
And has just fantastic hair. Her hair is so good.
It really is.
I don't know, like, if, like, her gravity powers make it, like, easier to do that, or if she just uses an unholy amount of, like, product or something, but her hair is gorgeous.
Well, they're going to do that Raven DLC, so maybe that'll be part of it.
That'll be, like, a whole side quest, is her having to go around to all the different shops at, like, Hexaville or whatever to, like, find, all her products.
Yes, indeed. But you know what I mean? It's like that's Kat is so unique as a center of this story because obviously there's plenty of superhero stories where the hero is idealistic, but there's something about Kat where it's not even, I don't even know if idealism is the right word. It's just that she is good and she expects goodness and she wants to do good.
I think it's not that she's idealistic. It's like she is just insanely optimistic. Like I don't think she really lives by a strong set of principles or something, because she's not thinking that far ahead about it. She's kind of like, in some ways, Nokia from Digimon Story or on the character from Persona 5, of that kind of like taking that what is oftentimes portrayed as a very negative character, the stereotype of like young women of like, oh, like being like naive and optimistic and seeing the good in people, and
like kind of like a ditzy chick.
Yeah, kind of ditzy is the negative way to phrase that. And but like taking that and being like, well, no, that's like, that's what makes her the hero, is that she's that kind of person, and that other people are not going to go out there. Like Lisa is not going to go out there and stick her neck out for people until she sees the value in that, because Kat is willing to forge that path ahead, even if she's going to stumble along the way, she's going to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I go back, you were talking about the author side quest.
Yeah.
And one of the things that sticks with me about that author side quest is that what sets Kat off on all that is that she hears this guy had a deadline and didn't fill it. And yeah. It is crazy to her that anyone would make a promise and not fulfill it.
Exactly. Because,
and that is so much if you've played Gravity Rush 1 and are now playing 2. That is who Kat is. If you ask her to do something, she will move heaven and earth literally to do that
yeah.
for you.
Yeah.
She will change the laws of nature. She will shift fucking gravity to make sure that happens. And so this fucking jerk-ass author won't fill his deadline. She is fine with throwing this dude in prison until he yeah. writes it. It's a yeah. crazy, funny, but so true to the character. And you're right, that character is so malleable because of that to tell all these different types of stories with.
Yeah, that she can tell these, like, big, grand, like, and, like, ridiculous anime cliche world-ending kind of plots, like the end of Gravity Rush 1 or something. But and she can also help someone move their furniture, and that can be a side quest in Gravity Rush. And, like, that's so magical. And kind of going back to some of the other stuff we were talking about, with going back to Raven, one of my favorite parts about the story and the character stuff in this game is that Raven gets to come in and be, like, you know, from more or less from the beginning. I mean, it takes a bit to get introduced to her. But once she enters the story, like, she is, like, a full active participant and, like, Kat's ally. And they have that sort of sisterly relationship they, like, have developed by the end of Gravity Rush. But you never really get to see them interact like that. And it's one of my favorite parts of Gravity Rush 2 is that you have that very sisterly relationship. But with the funny part is that Kat is technically older because of, like, weird time travel shit with Raven. And also Kat has been doing all this stuff longer, which is one of the reasons why the mining side quest is really funny, is that they take this, like, pocket scenario of Kat has been doing all this mining stuff. That's what you start the game with. And then when Raven comes back into the picture, she's like, oh, come mining with me. I'll show you the ropes, Raven. And these things, she's going to be like her. And it's if you know Japanese culture, she will be Raven's senpai, which is, you know, like, show her the ropes, be her, like upper, like, classman, upper coworker or whatever, that knows how everything works and can show the new kid around the block. But Raven's actually a lot better at it than Kat is. And that, like, kind of drives her up the wall. And it's that fun, like, sort of inverse, like, big sister, little sister conflict they have. And it's something that, playing the game, it made me realize, like, that is something, especially in video games, that, like, is so rare to find a story that is like that, of, like what is it, you know, like, fuck, like, talking about, like, the Bechdel test or whatever, but it's, like, it's so rare to find something where you have, like, two female main characters, like, that, like, are basically co-leads of the game, which Raven is more or less for some points of the game in terms of the story. But it's, like, the whole story is kind of, like, they are together for so much, and their relationship is so important and becomes more important as further the story goes on. And most of the main cast of the game are all women. Like, you have, like, Lisa, and you have CC and stuff, and there are some other characters that come in later. It's, like, and when I was talking to someone else about Gravity Rush, and I was trying to sort of describe to them, and one of my sort of, like, core points to go back to is that it kind of feels like it dropped out of this world of, like, PS2 character platformer yes. games, like a Ratchet and Clank and stuff like that. But if that genre had kind of still advanced in some ways, and, like, this just kind of dropped onto your lap. And when I was saying that, and I had been thinking about some of, like, the Kat and Raven relationship stuff earlier that day, I, like, had this, all of a sudden, this realization of, like, oh, right, and none of those franchises have a female main character. Like, I couldn't think of a one.
Right.
Like even going back to, like Banjo-Kazooie and stuff like that. Like, it's so rare, even though it's a genre that should, in some ways, be more open to that because it's not super militaristic or anything, so you don't have, like, some sort of excuse for it to have, like, oh, it has to be a dude or whatever. But it is, like, it's such a rare thing, and Gravity Rush 2, in particular, pulls it off so well that you don't even really notice it most of the time.
Yeah, it's just a world with strong, cool, interesting women.
Yeah. And that have really great hair.
That have really great hair and are awesome, but that's not a self-reflexive part of the game yeah. either. It's just who they are. That is rare in a lot of forms of media, yeah. not just video games. And, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's kind of funny you said Raven is there for basically the entire game. It makes it, you know, I realized today just how dense this game is because yeah. I got to, you know, I'm actually in the middle of episode 10. I played it up until the moment I had to leave to come and record this podcast.
Right, yeah.
As I often do. And, I think I got Raven at some point today. I played it a lot today. And I kind of realized once I got Raven and then once I got that second set of powers, the lunar powers, I was like, oh, I thought I had played a lot of this game.
Yeah, and it's like, played, it's just opening up, kind of.
I've played this game a lot.
Yeah.
I have not yet played a lot of this game. It's like two different things.
Yeah.
And that this game is densely novelistic. And I think novelistic is a word I come back to because it has that kind of scope to it where you really don't realize the import of things until they kind of start stacking up and stacking up. And it kind of, you know, feeds you things sort of piecemeal as you go along. And that's a, frankly, a very rare structure for video games.
Yeah.
Even games that are very literally novelistic, like The Witcher 3, it's not like you don't get Roach for 20 hours or something.
Yeah.
Not that Raven is like a horse, but you know what I mean. It's like just some other significant figure. So I really love that about the game. And it makes me, I don't know when I will find the time for this, but I kind of already can't wait until the day I can go back and play both this and the first game again.
Yeah, I really want to play them back to back.
Knowing what I know, just kind of going through and appreciating how well built it is, because it is really well built. You know, and I'm glad they didn't try to just start the game in Jir Dhaparalau with Raven there and with all your powers and all that. That would be a mess. That would be a clusterfuck. Frankly, would feel like most open world games. You know, this is a much smarter version of that kind of thing.
Yeah. No.
And God, if only Ubisoft, in all their collectibles, just gave you gravity powers, it would be so much more fun to go get the Animus fragments and shit like that.
Yeah, like, if I'm just, like, thinking about, it would be, I feel like, I haven't seen it yet. It has to be out there, and if it hasn't, it's just, like, a fantastic, like, 5 billion karma or whatever, like, image on Reddit waiting to be posted of just put, like, the map to, like, Watch Dogs or Assassin's Creed Unity or something next to the map of Gravity Rush 2. It's, like, how just stock full of insane, mindless bullshit of, like, any given Ubisoft game is. And, like, next to Gravity Rush 2, it's, like, the map is so clean. It's so pristine. It's so beautiful. It's, like, you've got, like, 3 side missions. You've got a main mission. You've got, like, 2 challenge missions. And then you've got, like, a couple of, like, manhole, like, teleport points. And that's all that's on the map. And it's, like, it's so navigable. It's so readable. It's so perfect. And I love it.
Yeah. And I actually barely ever even use the map because I just go into the missions tab and, like, which one do I want to do next? What sounds interesting? And I pick it and it puts on a waypoint, and I go there, and I have not even used the I've unlocked a lot of the manholes. I never use them because I just want to fly around and never fast travel, even though some of the distances in this game are crazy.
Yeah, I only really used it if I had to go from, like, the very bottom to the very top, or vice versa, because it's, like, although it's a weird thing about, like there's a weird psychological point that I realized very late into the game of, like, I was way more willing to go from the top of the map to the bottom than the bottom to the top, even though your whole fucking power is that those are literally the same thing, only you kind of have to stop, like, once to recharge your juice and go back up. And even sometimes, like, when you get really high level, you don't even really need to. It's like, but still, I was, like, so attached to the idea of, like, oh, it'll be so easy. I just jump and fall all the way down. I'm like, but that's what I'm doing either way. Like, what is wrong with my human brain?
I've been thinking about that a lot because one of the things I love to do, and I think this map just leverages Cat's powers so well.
Yeah.
Not that Hexaville in the first game didn't, but this one just takes it to another level, is that I just love, like, sliding around when I can, but then when it's time to, like, jump to another island, I often start by just running to the edge and jumping off.
Yeah.
Just, like, because I'm just going to jump, and then I'll figure out where I'm going because I can just fall through the air. And I just fall for a while, and I'll just kind of do that and then figure out where I'm going to go from there. And it's just this exhilarating thing every time where you feel that rush that Kat must feel of just, my first step is just to jump off this fucking island.
Yeah.
It's great. It's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or once you get lunar powers, I'm going to jump like I'm fucking original Superman of building in a single bound.
Yeah, no, like those lunar powers are really cool. And like the further I found, like, there's a really high sort of skill ceiling with being able to maneuver with those, because like at first they are like a bit unwieldy because you go all over the place. And then I felt like by the time I was at the end of the game, that, and then you unlock the Jupiter powers, which they've talked about that in the marketing for a long time, that there's the two of them, where the lunar makes you light, Jupiter makes you heavy.
And I just want to say, I followed none of the marketing. I had no idea that was coming.
Okay.
That was a complete surprise. I'm okay that you said, because obviously there's another power set. They told me it's the second.
Yeah, because you unlock, you're probably going to get them pretty soon because they're pretty close to each other when you get them.
But it was a pleasant, even though I didn't love that mission where they were introduced, it was a pleasant surprise to be like, oh shit, this, because again, I thought I was pretty deep into this and I'm getting a new set of powers.
Yeah.
So sorry, I interrupted.
But. Yeah, but yeah, like the very subtle ways in which your ability to sort of maneuver around the landscape as you, like, you get these new maneuverabilities and the new lunar and Jupiter powers, and like getting adept at switching between those quickly and using them in different ways because they are advantageous in different ways. And just like, I don't think I've had as much fun since Infamous Second Son of just, like, jumping around and navigating a city. Because I'm just, like, I really love falling and flying around in Gravity Rush normally. But there's something especially satisfying about the lunar powers of, like, doing, like, the long jump and then, like, doing, like, a flip and then getting ready and, like, wall jumping off of one building onto another and, like, wall jumping between them and then doing a super jump up. It's, like, it's so sort of graceful and ballet like her movement, and it's kind of like that Tokyo Drift thing. It's like, if you're not out of control, you're not in control or whatever, of like, you're just out of control enough to be like, at any second I might like just go careening off this island, but you're also mobile enough that you can at the last second like do a midair dodge or something and stop your momentum and then like switch to Jupiter and like fall super fast down. And the ways that those powers interact is really fun, and it makes navigating the cities really sort of addictive in a way of like, earlier today I was getting one of the last trophies I needed, which was to get Cat all the way maxed powered up, because like playing through the game normally you don't quite get enough gems to do that, and I had so much fun even just doing like what is a kind of like rote monotonous thing of the fastest way to do that is to load up a certain mission in the game and sort of collect gems at the beginning of that mission and then save and reload, and you reload at a checkpoint, and but you keep all the gems you got and just do that over and over again. But it was so much fun of just doing that and doing it in different ways and jumping around that, like, I just had a podcast on and I did that for like an hour and I had a blast. It's like, and I was fucking grinding in the game technically for it, a trophy, and I still had a huge amount of fun.
Oh, I mean, we do need to talk about this.
Yeah.
The controls. You could say this about Gravity Rush 1, but in some ways it's even more true of 2.
As someone who spent like half an hour today playing around with Gravity Rush Remastered just to sort of do the comparison, like, the controls in Gravity Rush 2 are like deceptively better.
Okay.
Like you will go back to Gravity Rush 1 and you will, one, go, holy shit, this frame rate is really fast. And then you will go, but this game does not feel as good as I remember it, even with a better frame rate.
Yeah, because even, but I was going to say, Gravity Rush 1 onto Gravity Rush 2, the thing that defines these games to me is the control. And part of that, and it needs to be acknowledged, is that there is wonkiness to it. And I actually think that's okay. Sometimes Gravity Rush 2 can be even wonkier, but that is a sign of it becoming better in some ways, that the camera sometimes has more trouble keeping up in combat and things like that. But that's really a sign of it becoming more ambitious, and as you say, that Tokyo Drift stupid line is actually really good for this, of if you ain't out of control, you ain't in control. That kind of is the motto of Gravity Rush, because the only way the illusion of this thing and the immersion of it works is if you don't feel completely in control of things.
Yeah.
Because the way, you know, Cat is not Superman. She's not flying around. She's shifting gravity and falling.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. And so I loved in Gravity Rush 1, and I think they leverage it just as strongly, if not more so, in Gravity Rush 2, of that sense of, you can go to all these places and you have this incredible sense of control where you can kind of go anywhere, but it's also a little wonky. You know, it's also a little like, I'm picking a spot and I'm falling there. I'm not specifically like holding down a button and flying and moving there. Do you know what I mean? Am I saying this right?
Yeah. Like, you're not a jet or whatever.
No.
Like, you're... There is something clumsy about the way that Cat moves, which is both natural to her character in some ways and to, the power she has. And that does... And then, like, on top of, like, some of the camera stuff is... when you think about what you are able to do in this game, of like, you are literally able to stand on every single surface in the game, whether that is the bottom of a floating city or on the top of the highest skyscraper, or especially with like your lunar powers, you can quite literally stand on like pinpricks, and like, because you're so light, you can sort of just like cover there a bit. The freedom of movement you have is like, of course there's going to be wonkiness, because you can't do this in Grand Theft Auto. You can't do this in Infamous Second Son, even, like, with all like the superpowers you have in that game. You don't have anything close to how ridiculous the freedom of movement you have in Gravity Rush, of just being able to like say, like, I'm just gonna like run along the bottom of this fucking like bridge or whatever, and to get these gems. There's going to be, like, the camera is going to do weird shit. Like, it's going to have the problem that every Spider-Man game has had since the history of time, of what do you do with the camera when you stick onto the wall. It's like, the answer is, the camera's going to go crazy no matter what you do. And, like, I think Gravity Rush handles that stuff fairly well, but you have to be able to accept a certain degree of wonkiness for having the sheer premise of the game be a thing you can engage with at all.
Yes, and that's what I was going to say, is that it's like, this is the rare case where I would say, technically, I have more camera problems with the sequel than I did with the original, but that's a good thing. That's a sign that they have opened it up even more and embraced more of what makes the game great. And I actually think some of that was with the mission I was saying when you get the lunar powers, I was really having problems with the camera there. And some of that is I don't love the level design in that one when you have to fight all the monsters there at the end. But also it's just, it's a sign of like you have to adjust and figure out, well, how do I play with this? And some of that means at first it's going to go a little crazy.
Yeah.
But then the more you get used to it, it's like, okay, I see how to work with this. And of course, I'm sure once I get all three sets, they'll work together better and I won't have those problems. But that is an interesting thing, that kind of when the game feels a little wonky is often when it's also its most exhilarating. Like, one of the best things to do in Gravity Rush is, you know, just go from point A to B, and on your way there, you see something you want to do down on the ground, and so you just say, okay, I'm going to hit L1, and Kat's going to fall, yeah. And she will just tumble and, like, hit a person on her way down and shock everyone, and then get up and, like, dust herself off and go on, and it is a very clumsy way of moving, but it is this beautiful and exhilarating way of moving, and yeah. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, you mm-hmm. know? It's such a great way to move around the city, and I loved it in Gravity Rush 1, but I feel like everything in Gravity Rush 2 is built around those mechanics that make this series so great.
Yeah.
It is such a great embrace of what this series does well mechanically.
Yeah, and it is something like with like the camera issues and stuff like that. I do love that there are like developers that are getting a reasonable budget that are able to make games where they just say kind of like, fuck it, we're going to like, that's how ambitious we're going to be, and say like, yeah, there's going to be camera problems. Like, we're not going to focus test this game to the point where those camera problems don't exist, and to make those camera problems not exist, we like gut some of the core mechanic of the game or something, which is sometimes what it feels like when you play an Ubisoft game or an EA game, is it's just like, you like this game is technically really sound, but there's like you don't feel the ambition. And one of the places with Gravity Rush 2 where you feel that is like in some places the frame rate also gets pretty chunky. And sometimes it was a little bit annoying. A lot of times it was kind of amazing because there is so much destructible shit in this game. And like, and you haven't even gotten the Jupiter powers yet, so you haven't even seen like the kind of havoc you can wreak on the environment. And yeah. just. Like, you don't notice how many boxes there are on the screen at once until literally all of them are exploding at the same time. And you're like, the frame rate notices how many boxes are on screen right now. But there's also, you could just tell that they are willing to have fun with it and say like, ah, if the console can't quite handle what we're doing here, that's fine because this idea is so goofy. Is that there is a late game side mission that revolves around you having to sort of attract crowds of people. And like, and to do that side mission, like, you basically have to attract literally 100 NPCs and have 100 NPCs following your character at the same time. And like, the game can in no way handle that frame rate wise. Like, the frame rate chunks like hell. But when you get, like, sometimes you get this view of where you look behind you and like, there are 100 fucking people chasing after you. And like, this is amazing. Like, it again, it's something else. Like, every side quest in that game is like, there's no other thing in this whole game that is like this other than, like, the challenge mission that you unlock where you do kind of the same thing, but it has a time limit and stuff on it after that. It's like, this and that challenge mission are the only time this whole thing ever pops up in the whole game, and they're willing to just say, fuck it. If the frame rate's going to dip to, like, 15 frames per second for, like, 2 or 3 seconds at a time, that's fine, because this idea is way too funny and goofy. Of course we need to do this. Like, let's just do it. And the player will be able to manage it. And there's something really fun about that to me.
Absolutely. I mean, this was so true of the first one. And I love that this was not diminished, but expanded for the sequel, which is that the core of this game is this wonderful sense of imagination.
Yeah.
Of just, like, anything is sort of possible in this game. And we are building this world where, as you say, you can stand on any surface. Anything can be a road to, like, surf on or something. It is such an interesting and such a free feeling mechanic that this is an open world. It feels like impossible to get bored with. When I'm going around grinding for the gems, I don't feel the way I do when I grind for like Animus fragments or something anything else in another open world game. It's fun because I just want to be moving around in the world, and the game itself knows that and leverages it in a lot of the missions and side missions and stuff too. It's just such a smart game.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the presentation a little bit.
Okay.
I was so happy when it started, and I saw that the comic book panels were still the primary way they told this story.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a little bit more of like in-engine stuff than there was in the first game, where characters will sort of stand and emote or something, but it's by no means the main way they do it. It is mostly through comic book like actual panels that are illustrated, or the sort of character panels that have dialogue attached and little speech bubbles. And it was such a special thing about Gravity Rush 1, but it's the kind of thing that came out of that game being a PS Vita game, which is that's a thing that in handheld games you get that sometimes, like in Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker or something like that, because it's a more limited way of telling it. But it is also, essential to Gravity Rush.
Yeah.
It is so essential that there is this just artistic core to it, that that's where the story happens, and then the actual open 3D world is sort of a different thing where you experience it, and that they kept that and, like, doubled fucking down on it is amazing. And it's amazing that, like, no one at Sony said, no, the only way we'll give you the money for this is if you make it a normal kind of game. I'm amazed that along the way it did not get bastardized in that way.
Yeah, to like you, that was like the moment where I was like, okay, like, this game is going to be what I want it to be. Is you had those comic book panels, because that was the thing that made me, literally the thing that made me fall in love with Gravity Rush Remastered and be like, okay, I need to play this game, was seeing those comic book panels, and specifically seeing that there were, like, manga style sound effects spelled out in their figgy language in the comic book panels. It's like, this game has such a insane, ridiculous sense of style of it is combining, like, on the screen right now, is combining, like, manga, like, weird French comic books, like Mobius comic books, and, like, American superhero comic books are all, like, blended in this ridiculous, like, those three things should not be blended together, but they are, like, so perfectly blended, and it's such a brilliant sense of style that, yeah, like, you could have a lot more, like, the in-game cutscenes with the 3D models, and the ones that they do have look very good. In particular, I think this game does a really good job at capturing the eyes of the characters, which is something that, like, I think is the biggest issue that a lot of anime art style has with, or anime / manga art style has with 3D, is it's very hard to get the effect of the eyes looking good on 3D models, because eyes are so important to that style, and the, especially like Kat, like, her eyes are really expressive in this. And I also really like that they I think they make kind of a conscious choice of, like, the way that her face animates is a bit framey. It's not super smooth, which makes it look comic booky. And, like,
it's anime. Something I wanted to say is that this does, you know, a lot of Japanese video games look like anime come to life. This looks like a manga come to life.
Sure, yeah.
And that's a thin line, obviously, but I do think it's an important one, and that this looks like it has the texture and the general movement and kind of the pencil strokes and stuff of a manga, not like a polished, colored-in anime.
Yeah.
In a weird, you know, whatever that weird line is, that's where it falls to me.
Or, like, I would even say, like, I would still say it looks like an anime come to life, a really good stylistic anime come to life, in a way that, like, a lot of Japanese games try to do that and do it really poorly because it just looks, like, plasticky and awkward. And it doesn't have, like, if you watch a really good, well-drawn, well-animated show, like, it will have, like, the characters will have, like, a vitality to them that I think a lot of 3D character models in Japanese games for a long time have completely missed. And here they have it 100%. And it is in, like, conscious decisions of having, like, the way her face animates is not super smooth. It has, like, you can tell it has, like, a specific frame rate. Or, like, I guess it wouldn't be that it has a frame rate. It's, like, it's the way they're animating it, because it's not, like, the whole game's frame rate changes. But, like, you can see the different movements in her face, like, in jumps, in the way that, like, you can in animation if you're really paying attention to it. And those choices are really smart. And then, like, you know, I still wish that there was an art book I could buy that is just all the comic book cutscenes in this game, that in just a physical art book, but maybe that might not actually be possible because they're, like I was saying earlier, on a completely different subject, like, digital comic books are just physical comic books that have just, like, the scans have been uploaded, basically. Here, it's, like, what they do with, like, the way the panels move and merge and, like, change into gameplay are some things that you couldn't actually do with a physical comic book, which is one of the things that makes it special.
Right, but I still would love, I think you could put together, at least, I would love, I don't, maybe there is one in Japan, I haven't looked for it, but an art book of, you know, Gravity Days, all the basic panels, maybe it's not arranged the same way it is in the game, but just to be able to study some of that art, because it is so beautiful, and there's so much attention to detail paid, and it's like, you do look at some of those, and you're like, this one cutscene must have taken for fucking ever for some, you know, person to sit down and draw the panels of, you know, because it's not something you can just, like, render in an engine. That's all handcrafted, and it's beautiful.
And I think they also have mastered comedic timing for that, because it's not just, like, comic panels. It's basically like a motion comic in some ways, but it's not weird the way that motion comics actually are. But it's like, you know, like, you'll switch to a panel and, like, the comic book speech bubbles will come up, and then Kat will go, like, Devon or whatever, and, like, characters will sort of slide out of frame and stuff. And there are a bunch of jokes that are really funny. In particular, It happens relatively early on. I think it's right before the one where you... It's the cutscene that plays at the beginning of the quest where you go to the Undercity for the first time and Vogo is counting all of his ship and stuff. He's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then Cat just pops and goes, Eto! And then he's like, 9. Wait, what? We have one too many. It's like the way that that is timed out, the comedic timing on it is so strong in a way that that cutscene done in 3D would not have had that sense of timing to it.
No. It's great. I mean, and just, again, reminding me playing this game of how much I love games that you read and have text. Sometimes, like, I think that gets lost sometimes in having, like, there's sometimes you can have too much voice acting.
Yeah.
And this game obviously has a lot of voice acting, but even when it's there, it's in their fake language, so you have to read it. And sometimes I love just reading through a game. There's a pace to it that this game wouldn't work if it were just all in English or in Japanese and you just listened along to it. That pace really does require you to be actively pressing buttons through it and saying, all right, I'm reading this, and I, you know, look away or just look at the art or something, and then I click on to the next one. It's so perfect for this game.
Yeah.
And I love that they were able to build out so much of this game, but some of those core things survived intact, this move from the Vita to the PS4 to a much bigger, you know, launch. This is a bigger... just released than Gravity Rush 1 ever was.
Yeah.
So, it's so great. So fascinating. I love that this is a series.
Uh-huh.
I love so intensely. I mean, you talked about that. It was exactly what I was thinking, is that this feels like there's a missing link in the evolution between the PS2 and then where we get to with Gravity Rush.
Yeah.
But it is part of that lineage. But, you know, if that had continued evolving through the PS3 era, which it mostly didn't, because developers like Naughty Dog went on a very different track. A great track, but a very different one. And then Gravity Rush comes in and feels like both a blast from the past, but also this, like, envoy from the future of, like, this is what a game can be.
Yeah, like, very appropriately it feels like it is a game that has fallen out of a parallel universe.
Indeed. And I just love that then we have fucking two of these. This one got this big release. There will probably, hopefully, one day be another one. This is just one of my favorite series of this generation, and I love that we can say it's a series.
Uh-huh, yeah, like, I love this game so much. And there's one other thing I want to talk about with, it's a small part of the game, but I think it's amazing. And it's actually just two things. It's the pictures, the camera, and the gestures you have are, like, two really smart things added. Like, one, it's almost kind of funny that, like, it feels like it's going to be, like, a meme or something at some point that every fucking game has a picture mode in it. With Final Fantasy 15, and then, like, obviously Naughty Dog has been doing all their, like, picture modes with their games and stuff. And then now, you know, Cat has this in-game camera where you can take pictures. And it ties into, I don't know how much of this you've engaged with, but it has this whole, like, online connective thing of you can... like, find treasure chests that are in the world, or you can, like, you get these online treasure hunt quests that sort of point you at where a treasure chest is, and a player that has found that treasure chest or has done one of these quests, like, has taken a picture of where it is in the environment, and then this quest is, like, uploaded seamlessly to the PSN, and you just sort of, like, get them down as little waypoints you can go to and go do them, and you see the picture they took of where the chest is in the environment and use that as a puzzle to say, like, okay, it's somewhere, like, in this area. Now find where it specifically is using this picture and using the clues in the picture, and you find that chest, and then you take a picture of where that chest is, and then the next player comes along and uses that to find that, and when they find it, you get, like, a little notification that's like, hey, I did this, and then you get, like, some dusty tokens or whatever that do some unlocks. And there are a lot of other small online features like that are, like, if the game does not have this big, broad online connective environment or anything. You're not doing Deathmatch in Gravity Rush. But it is a really funny image, isn't it, when you think about it? But it does sort of take a page from Dark Souls and Demon Souls and those games of saying, like, we don't need to have a big, like, intense online multiplayer thing. We don't need to have players dropping in and dropping out or then do all that shit and have competitive races. But we can take advantage of the fact that a lot of people playing this game are going to be connected to the internet, and finding little ways of doing that, of, like, you have a camera and they have the treasure chest thing. Or also, you can just take pictures of shit and upload it, and then players, like, other players just playing the game, if they're playing it online... it, like, those photos will kind of, like, randomly appear in their world, and if you see a, like, weird ghostly image of Cat, like, standing somewhere, you can walk up to it, press X, and you can see that person's picture, and you can either give it... I love the two ratings you can give. You can give nice with an exclamation point, or you can give okay with an ellipsis. It's like, it's either nice or okay? And, like, there's no, like, bad or, like, what are you doing? It's like, okay? And there's something really nice about that. I've gotten a couple of my, like, the servers have been down for a couple of days for maintenance or whatever.
That's what I was going to say. I have not been able to engage with it almost at all.
Because if you're playing it right now, it's been on first day, because it's like, I think they're going to come back up tomorrow, but the servers have been down for, like, today and yesterday, I think. But it is something that I got a couple of days ago, just, like, a whole bunch of my pictures that I've been uploading got, like, all these, like, nices and stuff. It was cool to just have that sense of camaraderie. And I think it's such a small thing they did, but it does add this whole other way that you can interact with the world that I think is very smart of, that you can take pictures of things and you can pose and you can do the gestures. And the gestures are so great because the people, the NPCs in the world react to you doing gestures. And my favorite way of, like, me discovering that was I did the second author one, which is the whole, like, Invasion of the Body Snatchers type side quest that involves, like, people pointing up into the sky as being, like, they are, like, a body snatched or whatever, basically. And at the end of that quest, you get that gesture to point up into the sky. And so I was like, oh, okay. And I hadn't done much with the gestures at that point. And so I just did that, and the cat points up into the sky, and a guy just standing behind her a little bit off to the side, kind of obscured, sort of sees her and goes like, huh? And, like, looks up at where she's pointing. And that, like, it all of a sudden clicked to me of, like, oh, and all of them, like, and you unlock a bunch of gestures in that game at some point. Like, all of them, the NPCs in the world will react to you. And when you're trying to take pictures, like, and you're trying to get the perfect picture posed, the NPCs will interrupt it in weird, funny ways because, like, they will stop and, like, look at you weird because you are singing in the middle of the street or whatever.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things in the game in general. It's just that NPCs do react because... Yeah. You wouldn't blame the developers at all if they said it would be too hard for the NPCs to react to some of this shit, right?
Yeah.
You would just think that would be too hard. But there's often, again, as I said, when you, like, drop to the ground from 50 feet in the air, people will be like, oh my, holy shit! Are you okay? Okay, you're okay. That's weird. Like, they will kind of back off and stuff, or you'll be rushing through and you will pick someone up with your gravity accidentally, and they'll be like, ah, you know? Yeah. That kind of stuff just adds this kind of color and character to it that is so good and immersive, you don't even think about the effort that must have gone into it. And then the other thing with the photo mode I wanted to say is I haven't engaged with it too much just on my own in the open world, although I really like having it there.
Yeah.
What I love that they do with it, though, is it's an actual mechanic through both main story missions and side missions, and I find that so impressive. I mean, imagine if in Naughty Dog's next game, like in The Last of Us Part 2, instead of just having that kind of photo mode that's obviously not part of the diegesis of the game, if Ellie just had a fucking camera.
Yeah.
And she, like, that would actually be an interesting way to build that character and do missions with that. And I think how deeply they integrated it impresses me so much, because this is clearly a thing that is going to be part of the future of games. And actually putting it into the diegesis makes this stand out in a way it wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah. And there is something really special to me about a game where, like, it's basically an open world game, and I can go around everywhere and just wave at people and they will wave back.
Yes.
It's like, that's something you don't fucking do in video games. That's something, like, you have to go back and, like, play, like, Spider-Man 2 on the GameCube or something, and, like, if you walk up to someone, I think it was that game, if you walk up to someone and you press the punch button instead of punching them or punching at them, you kind of wave at them.
I think that's right.
Yeah. It was some game that did that. It's like, it's so rare that you get to do anything to people in games that does not involve, like, either completely ignoring them or just killing them. And in Gravity Rush 2, it's like, And not only do you just, you can wave at them and they'll wave back, like, you can point up at the sky and they'll point. You eventually, and this isn't so much for the NPC reactions, it's more for me because it's the most adorable thing in the world. Eventually, Jonathan, you will unlock the ice cream gesture, and the ice cream gesture is the best thing in the world because it is just Cat eating a cone of ice cream, and it is, you will never see anything more adorable in your entire life. Like, in the way it is so lovingly animated, and the stages of her completely eating a cone of ice cream, like, down to the last bite of the cone, it is fucking perfect. And it's like, no other game would ever put that in there, but at any point, once you get this gesture, you can just fucking whip out a cone of vanilla ice cream and just eat it right there. And just, it's, you can just exist in this world. Or, like, there was a part where you're like, I was on this, like, tram in a mission that I think you probably haven't gotten to yet, and there I just had some sort of downtime where Kat was sort of monologuing to herself. I thought, like, oh, like, I'm just gonna sit down, and you can do there's like a rest emote, and, like, she just sits down and she's thinking to herself, and being able to do little tiny things like that, little gestures to sort of, like, personalize the experience and interact with the world in a very non-threatening way it's such a small thing, but it really, like, the story of Gravity Rush is all these small things that they do so right that it builds up to this, like, really beautiful game that is so much more than just the whole, you know, or it's so much more than just the sum of the parts. It's the whole experience. It is something where, like, you know, I just finished the game last night, and, like, it is still, like, weighing on me some of the stuff that happens in, like, just the experience. And you've been saying over and over, like, it has this novelistic sort of element to it. And it does, like, I have that, I'm still on that, like, down after finishing a novel, that sort of feeling of, like, I just want more of those cutscenes. I just want, like, more Cat. I want more, like, of her weird gestures. I want more, like, her joking around with Raven. It's like, I just need more of that. But the game is done. And it's like, it's killing me inside, you know? I have that feeling. And so few games can do that. That's like a Persona game can do that. Witcher 3 can do that. Like, Ocarina of Time did that when I was a kid. But it's so rare for a game to get that kind of effect out of me.
Absolutely. I can't wait to go home and play more. And, yes, you know, the other thing is that, you know, part of this was that I was playing Persona 4. But I don't think I would have probably finished this game at this point anyway, even if I hadn't. Just because I'm kind of just playing it at my own pace. And oftentimes I do kind of rush through games because of this podcast.
Yeah, we don't do that for this. No. Like, take your time with it.
Yeah, I'm just
Eat that whole ice cream down to the cone.
I'm just enjoying taking my time with it, and I love that about it. And we will obviously do a full spoiler cast on some of the more story-heavy elements.
Yeah, because I'm really excited to talk to you about what happened to the story.
And maybe that'll be next week, and maybe not. But I enjoy just whatever time I get with this game, and I can't wait to play more. And, man, I hope there's a Gravity Rush 3 one day.
Yeah.
You know, even if it takes them another 5 years. Maybe on the PS5.
Sure, fuck it, you know.
Or the PS Vita 2, when we finally get...
Yeah, that's definitely what's going to happen. You know? I mean, I think the PS Vita 2, I don't think they're going to make a PS5. The Vita 2 is where it's at.
Here's what I think, Sean, is the Nintendo Switch is going to be such a hit that they ditch the PS4 entirely and make the Vita 2, which is a hybrid home portable console, and Gravity Rush 3 is the, like, flagship title for the launch.
Except for they wouldn't call it the Vita 2, they'd call it the Swap.
All right, we're done.
Yeah. You know, hey, just keep falling.